I'm happy to call to order a meeting of the Joint Committee on Marijuana Legalization for January 13th, 2016. We appreciate you all being here, and I understand that people are still coming in, but out of respect for your time and because we've got a full agenda, we wanted to get started. Want to give you a little bit of a preview of what's going to happen today. We're going to walk through the two committee bills that the committee is considering for the session, which, you know, are still in development, and there will be some refinements and likely amendments introduced. But we've worked hard with a lot of you to try to craft these in a way that has broad support. So we're going to walk through those, invite some invited testimony on those two committee bills in a couple of different panels, and then we're going to move on to a hemp bill, two hemp bills, concepts that people are bringing so that they can describe those ideas, and then finally have an informational meeting on protective health standards. You probably know this, but a February session is famous for being so fast. These short sessions are so fast that it's important for us to do as much advance work as we possibly can. And one of the reasons we've had outreach with a lot of you over the last couple of months and the last month in particular is because we're trying to ventilate ideas and refine them and get them as good as possible in time for the sort of the starting gun of the short session sprint. And there's still time for us to make some tweaks and modifications, but it's a five-week session, and that's a really fundamentally different thing than what we all did together when we passed the bills that we passed last long session. So we need to do a lot of advance work, which is part of what we're doing today. I am going to start, I'm going to open the informational hearing on two bills, the base bill legislative concept 145, and which we refer to as the base bill, and the other, the expanded access bill legislative concept 180. And I am going to invite Legislative Counsel Mark Mayer to come forward and walk us through the key elements of those bills, including a couple of elements that were revised in the last 48 hours or so. So if you read a version that was posted a week ago, there's new information. Thank you, Mr. Mayer, for being here.
Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. These two bills may be categorized as, this is a lot of what is in LC 145, which is what I'll go through first, is technical fixes, although there are substantive changes as well to the law, and I'll try to point those out as I go through. And then 180 is, there are significant substantive changes to the actual state of the marijuana regulatory program in this one, which I will attempt to clarify when I address it secondly. The changes in 145 as I go through are largely going to be new sections that were added to the previous version. If you're looking at the new version, and there's a letter by the section number, like 13A or 21A or whatever, that has been inserted in the last 24 hours since the meeting on Monday. And so that's a really good way of seeing how these two drafts are different, the first version and the second version. So the first thing I want to talk about is changes to the licensing and registrant information that OHA and OLCC collects from applicants to enter into either the rec or the medical program. For the first 16 pages of this draft, we're primarily doing two things. First, for all marijuana-related businesses, removing the residency requirement from the law. And then for fees collected by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission for licensees, specifying that it's not just for that licensee, but that all the fees taken together may be spent on the program, so that it gives them more flexibility with their accounting and to where they funnel their monies. A technical fix. That is the first few pages. If you flip to page 16 or 17, section 8 is the patient cardholder section. And there are a few changes in here, but the most important change to the patient cardholder section is requiring OHA when somebody files an application for a patient card to use medical marijuana, requiring OHA to issue them a return receipt, and then that return receipt effectively functions as a medical marijuana card for 30 days, which is the period of time that OHA has to consider whether or not to award them a card. So for applicants, a little bit of breathing room in being able to participate in the program prior to either being accepted or denied.
Mark, could you point out the page and section so we'll just be able to tie it together, please?
All right. So for the patient card holder section, I think the most important language to look at is on page 21, lines 22 to 28. So for, and that's for any purpose described in the medical marijuana program, including exemption from criminal liability, a receipt issued by the authority verifying an application has been submitted has the same legal effect as a registry identification card for 30 days.
Great.
Page 22, section 9. This is a clarifying amendment. Basically, for the grow canopy statute, where the law directs the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to establish grow canopies for producers that are producing marijuana plants, it basically specifies in this amendment that that only applies to the portion of the premises that is being used to produce mature marijuana plants. It's merely clarification. Section 10, application processes. This is a technical fix that's going to help streamline the application process. The original law had OLCC requesting a land use compatibility statement from the county before they issued a license. And what we've done here is we flipped it and put the onus on the applicant to request that and then submit that along with their application form to the OLCC. So, just a little bit of a change there in the application process to help streamline it. The other change in section 10, page 23, on lines 21 to 24. This new language basically references the section of law whereby a city or county can refer to the people of the city or county whether or not they want to prohibit marijuana businesses. And that section of law basically says there's going to be a suspension of licenses during that period. And what this basically says is the land use compatibility statement, the OLCC, the city and county is not required to act on a land use compatibility statement request during that time period. So they don't have to issue them until they know the results of the election. Next section, section 11, pages 23 and 24 through 25. On page 25, the new language added to the research section, basically specifying that Oregon Liquor Control Commission will adopt rules by which limited amounts of marijuana products may be transferred by a research certificate holder to a licensee or other research certificate holder. And currently the way the law reads is OLCC is not required to allow those small transfers, but they can, and what this does is it affirmatively states that there will be limited amounts that will be allowed to be transferred. On page 26 and 27, section 11A, this is the section in law that currently regulates workers who must be permitted to work at a retail store. And we did a lot of criminal reduction last session, and originally what this language said is that a person cannot obtain a permit to work in a retail store if they've been convicted of a felony, except that the commission, we did so much criminal reduction, OLCC asked that, well, because he did criminal reduction, we like to fold in those marijuana crimes because there's a lot of misdemeanor now. There's a lot of misdemeanors now and violations. So we would like to fold in those marijuana crimes in order to be able to consider them. So is convicted of a felony or is convicted of an offense, so it has to be a misdemeanor, under ORS, and then these are the basic marijuana crime statutes. Except that we've still maintained the commission may not consider a conviction for an offense under those statutes if the conviction is 2 or more years before the date of application or renewal. So again, if you haven't been a bad actor for 2 years, they won't consider it. They're going to consider it within 2 years. Further down on page 27, section 13, this was requested by the commission, I believe, and it's merely clarifying that the commission can delegate its duties underneath the rec system, underneath the rec laws, to a director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, with the exception of rulemaking. Sections 13A through 13C, the headline is authorization to require fingerprints, and the page number is 28. There's going to be continuing work here. We did authorize fingerprints for licensees. We missed the research certificate holders and the laboratory licensees when we passed House Bill 3400. So for right now, what we have is we have some placeholder language, which is basic language that authorizes fingerprints to be taken by OLCC when they look at those two types of when they look at those certificate applicants or licensee applicants. Exemption from public disclosure. I want to specify here, this section does not make this information confidential. It's different than the similar sections in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act, which make the information confidential and therefore may not be disclosed. Here we have written into the law, information submitted on an application or kept and maintained by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission as related to a person who holds a license is exempt from public disclosure. So they don't have to release it if they don't want to. There's a difference there between those two types of statutes and how they're worded. Next section, section 14, more clarification language about within the grow limit statute about how personal agreements allow a grow site or somebody who's growing. If you enter into a personal agreement with your patient card holder, that's going to allow you to take that product and do something with it. So some more clarification language there on page 29. If you flip the page to page 31, the heading here isn't quite accurate anymore. Originally, this request was merely about inventory and moving from the OMMA system where you're submitting the information to OMA or to the health authority, and transitioning to a seed-to-sale system if you choose to change from being a registrant to being a licensee. The concept's somewhat expanded, and what we're basically directing the commission here to do is adopt by rule procedures whereby somebody who's currently registered under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act can transition to being a licensee, and it's pretty broad authority. What we have done is we have folded in there a requirement that OLCC, at the very least, don't have to do anything more than this if they determine they don't have to, but at the very least, they figure out what to do with existing inventory by those registrants. So you choose to flip. You're not currently subject to seed to sell. You got a bunch of stuff on your shelves or in your warehouses, whatever. How are they going to handle that particular inventory? So at the very least, they're going to look at that. And my understanding is there's some work in progress on that as well for reasons that the commission may want to address later. Section 18 on page 32. A lot of these fixes here are quite technical in that we had two bills go through last session, one 2041, which moved the tax over to the Department of Revenue, the other being the larger rewrite of Measure 91 bill. What we did with Section 18 is this section, which is currently, it's the bonding requirement for retailers, so that they'd be required to maintain a bond that's payable to the commission for purposes of tax collection and stuff like that. This particular section now rightfully belongs in the tax statute, so we're moving the authority over to the Department of Revenue, and we're going to be moving the statute as well during the next codification cycle. Page 33, local control, section 20. This section here basically does one thing. Now that there's currently only two methods by which a city or county can opt into allowing or prohibiting marijuana-related businesses to be located in the city or the county. One was passed by this committee last session, which is that the city or county refers it to the people and they take a vote. The other is by petition, where the people bring it by initiative and there's a vote. So both of them are subject to vote at the statewide general election. What this section does is it says if the board of a city or county decides they want to opt back in, very clearly they can do that without it being referred or without an initiative petition. The board can opt back in. It doesn't touch on the prohibition stuff. So if they want to opt back in, they can opt back in. Section 21, the new language is on page 35. If there is a referral and the people, let's say there's a county where marijuana is currently prohibited and there's a referral to the people and the people decide to opt back in through that referral process. Right now, it's not specific as to what date that becomes effective in the current law. What this merely says is that it's going to become effective on the first business day in January, immediately following the election. Otherwise, it would be on the date that the clerk certifies the vote or something like that, and it would be somewhat unmanageable for the agencies and the cities and counties. This gives a date certain as to when licenses will have to be issued. Section 22 on page 36 merely specifies that that cities and counties can enter into an agreement with the Department of Revenue for the purposes of collecting the marijuana tax, if cities and counties choose to adopt one. Page 38, section 23. This section here merely specifies, and this isn't necessary language. It's the state of the law anyway, but it is at the request of some of the committee members to make it very, very clear in statute that this is the state of the law. For the home growth statutes and the other statutes about home use regarding to general use of marijuana, and for cardholders and caregivers, that a city or county cannot prohibit or limit those allowances. And we're just making it very clear in statute. Section 23B, a new section, authorizes the governor to enter into an agreement with a federally recognized Indian tribe for purposes of coordinating our rec system with whatever marijuana-related business system that they would adopt through their own governance procedures. I want to make clear here, this is a permissive statute. It's not required. It doesn't require the governor to do this. It is, within the governor's, it's going to be within her ability to do this. It's permissive, not mandatory. Crimes. We did a lot with crimes again and crime reduction. There's been some confusion, unfortunately, about the crime reduction in this bill up to this point. No crime has been increased in this bill. I want to make that clear because I've gotten some information to the contrary. No crime has been increased. What we've done is we've gone back through and we've done further criminal reduction in certain areas, primarily with the two statutes that were untouched in House Bill 3400 about manufacturing and delivering within 1,000 feet of a school. And we further reduced those crimes so they're more in line with what is happening with the other statutes. We have tinkered with the homegrown and homemade statute. I do want to point out, Rob Avett from AOC pointed this out. We removed from the language homemade from this statute. And the idea there is that it's not only homemade products that you can have in your home, it's any product that you bring into your home you can have in these quantities. So we've removed that from statute. Section 27 on page 42, the import-export statute. The major change to notice here is that the original language only prohibited OLCC licensees from importing or exporting, and what we've done is we've now made that a person. So this statute now applies to any person who's importing or exporting. For the other parts of the crimes, I just want to reiterate that there is no crime reduction, or there's no crime increase, it's all reduction. Real quickly, though, Section 34, 475864, which is possession. If you take a close look at possession, what we've done is we've eliminated all the language related to a person under the age of 21. And on page 47, Section 34A, we've reinstituted some new language. And what the new language says is it's unlawful for any person under 21 years of age to knowingly or intentionally possess. And then there's A to F. That language is copied directly from what is permissible for adults to possess. So there's certain amounts that adults cannot possess. What we've done here is we said any person under 21 also cannot possess those amounts, or else it's going to be an A misdemeanor. If you possess under these amounts and you're a minor, in House Bill 3400 last session, there was a minor in possession statute was written, and that'll be the only option for prosecution, is to take them through the minor in possession statute. The feeling here is that it'll add consistency to the law and predictability to how cops can handle cases, because it'll be the same amounts and the same types of situations. Minors still will not be legally allowed to possess, but there is recourse for that. It's in the minor in possession statute, so it'll funnel them that direction. Section 35 is the open container law, and my understanding is there's going to be significant revision of the open container law as written here. The idea for the open container law is simply that right now what we have in statute is something that's modeled after the alcohol open container law, and a lot of issues have risen up about, you know, well, marijuana is a completely different substance, and maybe this isn't the correct model here. So my understanding is we're going to be revisiting this, and there will be some new language for this in a future version of this bill, or in a future amendment. On page 49, post-prison supervision and parole, the parole board may not consider or may not make a condition of parole, excuse me, or post-prison supervision a person refraining from the use of marijuana products for medical use if they are a patient cardholder. So if you have a valid card issued from OHA, you will have a right to use the medicine. Starting on page 49, we got a lot of technical and conforming amendments. I'm just going to skip those. Don't not look at them if you're interested in these bills. They're very technical, having to do with many bills going through last session and having to correct some of those errors, as well as conforming to some of the stuff we did in the criminal statute. So you're going to want to look at that stuff, but probably not worth your time for me to go over those right now. And at the end of the bill on page, if you flip all the way back to page 72, there are several short sections requiring the Oregon Liquor Control Commission or the Oregon Health Authority to convene work groups or conduct studies, and you'll probably want to take a look at those and see what they're about. The one I want to draw your attention to is the pilot project, which directs the Oregon Health Authority in coordination with the Liquor Control Commission to establish a statewide program, for the purpose of establishing a statewide program during the next biennium to develop an evidence-based pilot project for the purpose of increasing awareness among youth of the impact of using marijuana and marijuana-derived products. There's also language in there about being a multimedia public campaign and having a request for proposals and that sort of thing. You'll probably want to take a close look at that. I know that it has been of great interest to a lot of people. And that is pretty much the content of this bill. Again, a lot of it's technical, necessary fixes. There are some substantive things in here, especially with the criminal reduction. Is there any questions on LC 145?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Co-Chair Burdick.
One of the things that has occurred to me is we do this great work on reducing these penalties for drug-related crimes. Is I just want to kind of get a sense of what the status is for people who commit crimes associated with legalized marijuana, for example, people who grow it at home and then sell it. Those crimes are still in place, is that right?
Correct. All we've done with the crimes is reduction in penalties. But the status of the crimes and how they relate to the provisions allowing for home use and for sharing in home use, the substance, the elements have remained the same.
And card holders who would get medical marijuana and then sell it, that's still a does that still have criminal penalties?
Correct. Patient card holders can't sell. There are certain privileges that they're allowed underneath the Medical Marijuana Act. That is not one of them. They cannot give consideration or they cannot deliver. Basically, there's a statute that says they cannot deliver marijuana, and that has not changed either. But that works a little bit differently than the home grow, home use statute because there's a kind of a catch-all for patient card holders. It's just like you're exempt from any criminal liability unless you do – there's like three or four things, driving while intoxicated, delivering, and a few other things. I can't remember what they all are right now.
Those haven't been –
They haven't been changed.
Yeah. Thank you.
Right. It looks like there are no other questions right now, and so I'd suggest that we move on to Legislative Concept 180, and then we'll have some time for questions, and if people want to circle back to something, yeah, that'd be great.
LC 180 is it's kind of a larger concept bill. There's a lot more substance here, but there's basically three things that are happening, and I'll start with the back end of the bill because it's a lot easier and move to the front end. There are three major policy considerations in here for the committee to look at. The first one begins on page 25, section 18. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Page 23, section 16. The heading is Early Start. We have added three items to the Early Start statute, which will allow medical marijuana dispensaries to sell additional products prior to December 31st of this year. Those products are edibles, non-psychoactive topicals, and pre-filled carbon dioxide vaporizer cartridges. So those three types of products. There are similar limits on the amount that can be sold by a dispensary, as with the bud and the leaves. And then we've also written in here that limited marijuana retail products sold by a dispensary under the statute must be tested as prescribed by the authority. We kind of had to be a little bit loose with the language there because my understanding is the testing laboratories aren't online yet, but we wanted to give them some general authority to maybe adopt some general testing guidelines for some of these products. So that's the first thing. The second policy choice for the committee to consider is on page 22, section 15. And this statute basically says any retail store, if you go into the store and you're a patient card holder and you show them your card, then the store sells you the product tax-free. So we have a 17% tax on all cannabis that's sold by recreational stores. If you have a card, you'll be free from that tax. They'll sell it to you tax-free. Then the final policy point, which is the bulk of the bill, I'm going to try to just describe it generally, though, is the expanded access concept. And basically what that concept says is if you're an Oregon Liquor Control Commission licensee, whether you're a producer or processor or wholesaler or retailer, and you specially register with the commission in a form and manner prescribed by the commission and meeting any qualifications they choose to impose, then you can engage in the distribution of medical grade products. If you're a processor, you can process them. If you're a retailer, you can sell them. If you're a wholesaler, you can sell them, et cetera, et cetera. That is part of what I assume to be kind of like a permanent look at how these two distribution systems might look. The other part of it is that there can be, if you are specially registered to engage in medical business as an OLCC licensee, you can sell product into or buy product from a registrant underneath the medical marijuana program as it is now written. A grow site can sell to a retailer, et cetera, et cetera, and the product can go back and forth between the two systems freely. The key is all product must be tracked at the production or processing stage, is how we've written it. So if you choose to participate in this, whether you're a producer in the rec system selling into the other system or vice versa, that product has to be tracked. And that's the way it is currently written. There are two other minor components of the bill. One is that if you're an OLCC licensee, producer licensee, and you choose to engage in this business and specially register, you can serve patients underneath this concept under agreements. Instead of a card system, it's an agreement system where you can grow for specific patients and then underneath an agreement give them product underneath that agreement. The marijuana you grow underneath that agreement is not subject to the plant canopy. So it's in addition to your grow canopy. So that's the first little component. The second component is we have specified for each of these different types of licensees that OLCC is going to treat the distribution of these two types of products, general use products and medical grade products, the same, excepting where there is a public health and safety reason for treating the products differently. So in other words, it'll freely flow through the recreational system. A wholesaler will be able to give medical grade products to a retail store. A retail store will be able to sell them to cardholders. And that's pretty much the bulk of this bill. Any questions on 180?
Yes, Senator Pozanski and then Senator Burke.
Clarification on the last part. What sections does that include in the sense of where, what I'm hearing is that medical grade marijuana, high concentrations will be available for recreational users.
No. You can only sell it to cardholders. I think is that part of it the way it's written right now? Yeah, the idea is, and if it's not in there right now, it's my error. The idea is that the medical grade product will be for cardholders within the
Thank
system.
Co-chair Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Under this draft, and this has been a subject of controversy, if the recreational grower is selling into an OLCC dispensary, they have to be seed to sale. But if they're selling into a medical dispensary, do they? You said they have to have tracking. Is it seed to sale still?
No. If you choose, we have not touched the medical statutes. If you choose to stay in the medical system and only sell in the medical system, then the state of the law remains the same.
Correct. But I'm talking about the recreational grower who wants to also sell into a medical-only dispensary.
Yeah, that has to be tracked underneath this draft.
To sale?
Seed to sale, correct.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mark, on Section 15, on the forgiveness of tax for medical cardholders, does the tax collected there cover any locally imposed tax, or is it just the state levy tax? I can't find that section.
Right. Let me read it real quickly. It's been a while since I wrote this provision. It seems as if this is written specifically to the state tax, and if we wanted to add back in the local tax, we would have to specify that more clearly. We've linked this to the state tax, the 17% tax. Or if the committee wanted to consider that.
Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mark, on the issue of the OLCC licensee who wants to sell into the medical system, again, they get the special designation, special registry. How do you envision that? What does that look like?
The commission might be able to answer that a little bit better than I can, but the envision is that you would simply have – I talked to Mr. Patridge a little bit about it. He said you could have on your application a special place where you could designate that this is something that you want to do and maybe pay a slightly increased fee for doing it. I would assume that there would also be some kind of portal to allow people who want to do it after they've been licensed to join in.
Okay.
But they would probably know a little bit more about how Great. They would execute it than I would.
Thank you.
Any other comments for now? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor. We're going to move into invited testimony. And, Mr. Mayor, if you can be available in the event questions come up later on, that would be great. But we will have a series of panels, and we're going to begin with a panel of Oregon Liquor Control Commission representatives, Chair Rob Patridge, and Will Higlin, who whose title I am a little unclear on, but who does great work. I'm really happy to see you. And then after that, we're going to move to a panel of OHA representatives and then have three panels of stakeholders. Welcome.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rob Patridge. I'm the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'm happy to be here today. Steve Marks couldn't join us today, who is the executive director, who you're used to seeing. Steve is under the weather today, as are many staff at the OLCC and around the Capitol, I hear, today. Will Higlin is here today, and his title's too complicated as well, so I'm not gonna, I'll let Will say whatever his, his title is today.
I am Will Higlin. I believe I'm the Senior Director of Licensing and Compliance at the OLCC. It's great to be here.
But Will is running the marijuana program and running our programs generally at the OLCC. We've done pretty much a merger of most of the programs at OLCC in order to maximize staff and in order to run efficiently. I think that that's going rather well, and Will has set up a really unique and dynamic culture that has everybody at the OLCC excited to be doing new things. Well, most people. I won't say everybody, but most people at the OLCC excited to be doing this licensing and regulatory work. So we appreciate the opportunity to come before you today to comment on both of these particular drafts and maybe what the OLCC envisions related to these drafts. We acknowledge for sure that we've tried to work very collaboratively with the industry since your last session ended to try and build a set of rules and put those temporary rules into place. I think our process has been good. I think it's been very open, I believe, and very transparent. We're also happy to inform you today that despite the fact that state government was shut down around the state on January 4th, the OLCC did launch its online licensing process. And Will braved the storm and a few key staff to make sure that that was turned on and processing well. You'll also be pleased to know that we set up a call center at OLCC in anticipation of the flood of incoming applications for marijuana. We as of Monday, we shut that kind of emergency call center down because we were not getting the flood of questions that we anticipated. We hope that that's because we've gone around the state, and Will and his team did a phenomenal job going around the state and met with stakeholders around the state and answered large licensing questions as well as many commissioners to try and make sure that people knew what was coming. And if you look online, I think you'll see our book about how to apply at OLCC and the regulatory things, not only at OLCC, that the governor's office led that effort with us to help make sure that that new business owners in this industry would know what to do. So we've tried to be very proactive about those things. Today, the bulk of our comments will focus on both the base and expanded bill. First, on the first related to the base bill, which is LC 145. We've heard a lot about residency. We at the OLCC and the Legislative Advisory Committee that we put together, or the Rules Advisory Committee, the RAC Committee that we put together, acknowledged the controversies related to residency. We received a letter from this signed letter individually from members of this committee related to the thoughts related to residency. We have tried to accommodate that at OLCC. Representative Leininger and I happen to be speaking at a conference together at the Oregon Judicial Conference, and I think we put together a concept based on that conversation that I had with Representative Leininger related to allowing people to get into the queue until this committee had an opportunity to really address the residency requirements. But just know that that's in place, and we are poised and ready to do whatever the legislature directs us, but that nobody is losing their place in line should you change the residency requirement. Should you change the residency requirement, those people who didn't meet it will be placed in the queue where they were when they applied. But you'll see, as we'll walk you through that later on. In addition to that, the simplifying of accounting fees, that was of grave concern to the agency, the way that that ultimately got written. This legislative concept fixes that and requires that licensing fees combined will pay for the agency's overall pay for the overall marijuana budget, that it doesn't have to be every specific license that's accounted for every single thing. And I will talk about that as we talk about some other ideas the OLCC has, that the change in this fee, simplifying the accounting fee concept, will allow us to do that we think will meet what we've heard testimony about, what we've heard around the state. We're calling it kind of a micro canopy concept, but I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The land use compatibility statements for sure are we think are a good change. So that the applicant goes to get those, so that the OLCC is not trying to get those after the fact. We think it's a good idea, and it allows people to work with their local governments a lot more on the front end rather than the back end. In addition to that, in the base bill, we've got the bond language, which we talked about, the delegation of authority, which we have in liquor, the bond bill, back to Department of Revenue, and the liquor funds reimbursement, so that Department of Revenue and OLCC can close out the OLCC's books. I'd like to talk a little bit about this micro canopy concept. I talked about it related to fees, but there's been a lot of interest in smaller, more family-owned, small farms coming over, or people coming over from the medical side necessarily. It doesn't have to be from the medical side, but there's a lot of medical growers who are interested in having the ability to do some things within the OLCC system. With the change of fees that we would require, OLCC would like to now work hand-in-hand with the industry. We plan on doing the same kind of outreach we've done with every single other licensing process to try and address the needs of the small business owner, kind of the what now might be a 48 or 100 plant grow on the medical side. People want to keep it small. People want to keep it within their system. We'd like to have the fees lower on those so that the barriers to entry and the barriers to tracking in the OLCC system are not hard. It would make a lot more sense for us. We're looking at the really small canopy sizes with those types of grows, and we want to work with industry to make sure we get those numbers right. In addition to that, we had tried to build into, we worked really hard with industry during our temporary rules process to build into the fact of a security waiver process. There was a lot of concern from industry that there was going to be all these massive security requirements. I think that was a lot of what was flying around as OLCC was involved with the legislature last time. We tried to assure people that we would have some kind of waiver process. You know, if somebody's way out on rural property, it's not the OLCC's intent to make them build huge high fences and run a electrical line for video surveillance and do those kinds of things. Our important part of our security is really to be able to make sure that the crop doesn't get taken and distributed elsewhere, and to provide security. So that's what we want, and accountability in the system. So there's a lot of opportunities under the OLCC has really broad-based waiver opportunities currently as it exists, and obviously those are going to happen as we're going to build up how we adopt those things. But I think that's going to even be further enhanced, and we'll try and provide some kind of some kind of guidance as we look towards the sizing of these micro farms and how far they are from, you know, current roadways or other types of things. So our idea on this micro canopy concept is keep fees low, keep their costs low, and balance that against, you know, what the safety needs are. And I think that OLCC has been really committed to making sure that that happens. We've done the same thing in alcohol on the micro distilleries and the micro breweries. We've tried to keep our costs low. We've tried to not be overly burdensome, and we've tried to create creativity.
May I jump in?
Yes, absolutely.
So I think one of the things that we didn't mention in the initial walkthrough of LC 145, but would if we pass LC 145 as a bill, give clear direction from the legislature to undertake this kind of tailoring to fit micro businesses, is on line D of page 2. It essentially says, you know, OLCC, please work to develop some opportunities that enable very small businesses to have a chance to have a meaningful role in an OLCC licensed sector. And so I feel like that's, you're giving some great examples of what that might look like, but you rightly acknowledge that a stakeholder process to determine what's really needed and what you can do would follow if we were to pass this legislation. But it sounds like the intent here matches very much what you're
absolutely
suggesting.
And it's what we'd like to do, and we're now able to do that because of the fee structure.
And then Rep. Wilson has a comment.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, thank you. I'd like to vouch for the micro canopy licensure, or whatever we want to call it. You know, that's extremely important in our district in Southern Oregon. I know the winds are blowing the way they're blowing on the residency requirement, but with that, I've got to say, from what I understand, the product produced in my district stands on its own merits and will over time. But yet, you know, we're very sensitive about the condition of small businesses, small family farms in Southern Oregon, and really want to see this come to pass, so yeah, we would appreciate that. Thank you.
And then Rev Helm had a comment too.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is great. I'm really happy to see the agency embracing this idea. I think it solves a real problem and an important problem. Somehow these smaller family farms need to be protected because they're the innovators in the industry in one way or another. I just encourage you to add another category to the group of folks that you make sure you talk to, and that is your city and county planning departments. Somehow, if a licensee goes through your program eventually and gets a license in this special way, they need to get credit for that with the local planning department, because that's a signal to the county that here's a grower, here's a producer, here's the type of applicant that's going to follow the rules. They need to be rewarded for that. The folks that are not following those rules and want to be sort of these rogue actors out there, out in the sticks, they need to be punished for not following the rules. Let's not punish the good guys while we're trying to work out how the land use works in the counties. Thanks.
Thank you. Senator Przanski has a comment.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So, Rob, what I'm hearing, I just want to make certain, you're potentially going to set up a new classification that's going to be for, as we're calling it right now, micro canopy growers. I guess the question is, if these individuals are already in the OHA program, they are already being required to do some type of tracking. Clearly, and I'm going to state this again because it seems like OHA hasn't got this message, they're not to do seed to sell at OHA. It's supposed to be something less from what all this committee has went through in the last time. So if we have that system, it seems pretty straightforward that having them coming into anything that's doing with OLCC, where you do have seed to sell, you already have a cross-check as to that they're in compliance. So I'll be interested to see what else you feel that you need to put in place that's going to be greater than what's already being required of these small family grow operations. Because as you've heard, it's very important for many of us that we're not going to displace them out of the market area and allow for someone that has much broader capital to be able to displace their ability to be in a equitable market arena.
co-chairs and Senator Pruszynski, we're going to work hard with the – we're not trying to displace anybody or displace the Oregon the medical marijuana program within the state, but this will allow us, because of the fee change, because the way we had the fees before, everything had to be fully burdened on – rather than we're buying this whole software system, but it, instead of it having to be equitably done at this point in time, we're going to have it – we're going to be able to – reduce fees, we're going to be able to look at other concepts, we're going to be able to do some things that are really small business friendly, mm-hmm. we believe. It doesn't mean – I think that this potentially, depending on how the legislature views LC 180 as well, may have a duplicative effect for these small farmers who really want to continue to do medical and also really want to be on the rec side and be creative and be innovative and do those things. So, you know, I think that that can work hand in hand, but – separate and apart from 180, we want to be able to do this micro concept, which we believe will look at the people in Representative Wilson's district and other places around the state that mm-hmm. we know are the small farmers today. So, I'll go quickly because I know your time is. Was there a question? Sorry. So the other pieces we want to do related to this, which we've tried to build in the rules currently, but we'll revisit related to the micro concept, is flexibility in minor control plans, because we know these people are producing where they live. So we have flexibility in the minor control plans. We want to revisit that and make sure that that's going to work for these more micro grows, because, you know, we've tried not to have minors in, but if they're living there and their kids have somebody over for a, you know, a play date after school or something else, we want to make sure that those types of things are accommodated and that there's no stigmatization related to what's going on there. Primary residence protection, you guys built into the bill before. Again, we want to make sure that people understand that. Visitor logs, we have visitor logs in some of these larger grows. We want to look and make sure those requirements will meet the micro family farm and may scale back some of those kinds of things. And then the cannabis tracking system. We want the legislature to know that the cannabis tracking system is going to be, you know, there's no cost of entry for the cannabis tracking system other than the licensing fee that these people are paying. So they're going to get access to the cannabis tracking system. Really, it's the tag cost, which I think range between 30 and 70 cents, depending on tags you use or whatever.
45 cents.
What our plan is and what we'd like to do, maybe at some point in time if this committee has time or we'd offer it to do it during the legislative session, is to bring in the tracking system, set it up in a room or present it to the committee or leave it in a room depending on what legislators want to do for a day, so that legislators could come in, could see what it looks like, could see kind of what the burden is or isn't, so we can explain it to people. If you'd like us to present to the committee, we're really happy to do that. We don't think it's going to put a substantial burden on the small growers, because they're going to have, you know, pretty good access to a technology that's there and at a low cost. And so that's what we wanted to share with you.
Great.
But
thank you.
So that's on the micro concept. In addition to that, we would make some comments on LC 180. We want to make sure that the potential licensees meet the OLCC license application requirements, which we believe is built into the current legislation. It would give the OLCC our ability to oversee and enforce the rules on recreational and medical product in the recreational licensing system, and all products are checked. Are going to be tracked within the OLCC cannabis tracking system. So, again, we want to be able to show you what that looks like should we have that opportunity in February. You know, we heard this in all of our meetings, that there was a strong theme about having this kind of access model. And we heard that around the state, and we've continued to hear that as people apply. We know that there's a very strong interest in doing kind of a dual system. There's not a lot of one-off pharmacies running around out there, frankly. There's a lot of people who are interested in doing both and being innovative and giving patients access to medicine in a wider variety of places. So we have heard that on the road. We worked hard during the session to work on that.
Pardon me. I think Senator Farioli, did you have a comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the agency's list of objections to co-location is evaporated. The agency's list of objection to the idea of co-location of medical and recreational has just evaporated?
Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, it hasn't evaporated because this, we've always said that we would, we are in favor of bringing these two together as long as they're tracked seed to sale or in our system. This would allow the tracking within that system, and that's the concept that we put forth in writing and everywhere else. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
Well, Madam Chair, I'll remind our colleagues from the OLCC that we had a lively discussion about attitudes toward co-locating medical facilities and recreational facilities, and I seem to perceive a pretty significant resistance, to which I inquired about and requested a list of the objections that you had to co-location. I have never received a contact from your office regarding that question, which I put on the record. But Mr. Chairman, what I understand from your testimony is that we are moving toward co-location, and that is being facilitated through the seed-to-sale tracking system. Is that, am I tracking?
Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, I'm not sure of whether, I'm pretty sure we sent a response, but if you're telling me we didn't, then maybe it didn't get there or not, but I know that there was, we had worked on a response at one point in time related to objections to the system.
Madam Chair, I asked for a specific list. I tell you I never got it. Kay. Thank you.
And I don't, I'm not saying one way or the other. All I'm saying is I don't believe that OLCC has changed its position.
Okay. Senator, I'm going to actually just make a quick comment, and that is I want to thank you for what I see as really great teamwork in, you know, addressing concerns that you have had so that this model can meet the needs of any needs that you identified. And I know that OLCC talked to me about the response that you were preparing for Senator Farioli. So I know that you've been working on something and that it was a while ago. So if for some reason it got lost in transmission or something, I just want to vouch for the fact that I know that a while ago you were talking to me about your response. So they had been working on it. And whether or not
it ever
got to your... I saw a
draft response, Senator, so we were trying to be responsive. So if it didn't get there, I apologize.
But whether or not it got there, you've been working hard to overcome your barriers, and it feels like this project that you've helped shape hopefully does address those. Senator Przanski had a comment.
Let me just follow up on what Senator Farioli said and give you an example. You've got a grower in the medical side. They're growing, let's say they have excess of 2 pounds. They want to get that into the recreational side. Does your vision, will it allow them to stay and do what they're doing on OHA with the requirements of what they're required there, take that 2 pounds, introduce it into the recreational system, and at that point, when it comes into the system, is where you get to track it as seed to sell, and you should be able to cross-check and cross-reference, because we know what they had to report for OHA, we know what they're saying is coming out and now going into the rec side. That seems like that's some type of a crossover that's not going to be belaboring for the growers to be able to have this excess move into that arena, and you'll be able to track it once it comes in, just like you will any other product at that stage. Is that something that's going to be possible?
Co-chairs and Senator Przanski, I don't believe as written, at least as the way I read this as written, is that it would have to be in the seed-to-sale tracking system, and then it would, then it could be sold through the OS. It wouldn't be like, it wouldn't be a one-off in the OHA system and then come over. They would opt in under LC Concept 180 and be able to sell within the recreational system that's tracked seed-to-sale. We do have a provision for them to come over and become an OLCC licensee without losing the plants that they've grown or the product they may have on their shelf. We have to build in what those parameters are going to look like and rule, but that's but they could come over, but they don't get to sit on one side and continue to sell into the other. We're trying to this creates the opportunity, I believe, for it to come across if they opt into the seed-to-sale tracking system.
So I'd want to note the time. It's 3:05. We had you budgeted until 3. Is there more content that you need to share?
We'll have some quick comments that he can run through just on an implementation update of what's gone on currently.
Madam Chair, as a member of the committee, again, I'm Will Higlin. I'm the Senior Director of Licensing and Compliance at the OLCC. So I will be brief. I think I have a couple minutes here. But first and foremost, I really want to echo Chair Patridge and his appreciation for this committee and the work in addressing different issues and making changes in legislation to help streamline implementation and respond to unanticipated stakeholder needs. Many of the concepts in these legislative drafts address issues that will aid our agency in streamlining our application review process, ultimately resulting in better customer service to our licensees. We recognize that this is a very fluid environment, so if we have any other comments or further review that pop up, we will make sure that you get those before the session starts in February. With that said, I have to say I'm very proud of the commission and the staff at the OLCC. It's been all hands on deck to hold stakeholder meetings, adopt temporary rules, develop an online application system, and train potential applicants. In December, we held 6 meetings throughout the state to train potential applicants on rules and how to prepare to be a successful applicant. In Bend, where most surrounding cities and counties, as you know, have opted out, we expected maybe 75 people. We had over 300. We went to Medford. We thought we'd have 400. We had 600, and the transition just kept going throughout the state. So at the end, in total, between Bend, Medford, Eugene, Salem, and 2 meetings in Portland, we had over 4,000 attendees. One strategy was to inform the applicants about how to access information on the marijuana.oregon.gov website. Since its inception, we have had 1.5 million hits, with many people downloading the frequently asked questions, the PowerPoint presentations, and the workshop video. We set up a call center, as the chair mentioned, to field questions and answer emails at marijuana@oregon.gov. We have been able to keep up and provide direct, immediate service to those questions, and we are adding the answers to our most the answers to our most commonly asked questions on our website.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I'm going to ask you to wrap up in a minute. I'm sorry to do this.
Okay, I'll just go through the numbers. I think you'll be interested in this. So as far as the numbers of applications we've received, we mentioned on the ice storm, we actually got through 145 applications that were paid and completed with nobody in the office but a couple of us. So that is a testament to the system. It came up, it worked, and so we were thrilled with that. As of yesterday, we have 300 applications completed, 202 are in the system in draft form, 42 are ready to be paid, so we have 544 in the system currently. We have 170 producers. We don't have any laboratories yet. We have 29 processors, 25 wholesalers, 1 research, and 75 retailers across the state. And in the essence of time, unless you have questions, I'll stop there.
Senator Ferriola.
Thank you, ma'am.
Sure.
Have you, in the process of licensure, have you formed an opinion about how many of the medical producers, the dispensaries, are going to migrate to the recreational side?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, no. Really, we've heard it all over the board. I guess if you ask me honestly, I've heard that many of them are, or most of them will, but we haven't done any of that analytical work yet. We've just started pulling the applications off the system. I've set up a system where we're going to start slow. So we're doing team investigations now. I'm very concerned about consistency across the state and how we look at these applications before we actually approve them. So we're doing kind of a team training before we start divvying them out. So the first process is that. But until we actually go through them, I really don't have a real answer for
you. Madam Chair, can I ask that question in a different way?
Yes, sir.
Have you been encountering people that are currently involved in the medical dispensaries that have insisted that they will stay in the medical side and have no interest in moving to the recreational side?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I've heard that too, and I've also heard the other side of that. I've heard that many of them are going to come over, so I really don't know.
Okay, until Madam Chair, I'll pursue this when OHA is before our committee.
Great. Thank you. And thank you, gentlemen, for being here, and to OLCC for working hard and effectively, I think, on a tough project.
Great. Thank
we
you.
Now Thanks. Have a panel from OHA coming up, and we have Michael Tynan, who is the policy director, and Andrea Orso, section manager. Andre, pardon me. And we are a little bit behind schedule, but you have a very important part here. We look forward to hearing the thoughts that you have to share.
Sure. Thank you. So, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leininger, my name is Michael Tynan. I'm the Policy Director for the Public Health Division in the Oregon Health Authority. I'm joined by Andre Orso, who is our Senior Manager in the Medical Marijuana Programs in Public Health. We appreciate your invitation today. I'm going to give a brief high-level overview of what public health's role and responsibilities are in this, and then Andre will get more into the detail of the programmatic efforts. So we want to focus today on updating you on the activities that public health has been engaged in since Deputy Director Priscilla Lewis presented to you in November. We'll also update you on some new topics that you haven't heard about yet. As Deputy Director Lewis mentioned in her previous presentations to you, our role remains the same, protecting the public's health, regulating medical marijuana and dispensaries, and accrediting laboratories. We have a role also required by House Bill 3400, which requires us to establish serving size and standards for product labels for both medical and retail marijuana products, and we'll provide you some brief information on that. As a part of our strategy to protect public health, we have an interest in protecting children and preventing youth initiation of marijuana. We've begun conducting substantial research on which messages resonate with youth, and in October and November, we conducted 8 focus groups across the state, testing messages that help youth and children understand the impacts of marijuana use. Our focus groups were for ages 14 and 17 and 18 to 20. And in addition to finding the messages that work, we also identified who the trusted messengers were for each of the age groups. We've used messaging in some of the early materials that we've developed, like a parent guide and brochure and the retail signs that are currently in stores, and we plan to use these messages in future materials as we develop them. Additionally, we're collaborating with the State Department of Education and the Alcohol and Drug Policy Commission to identify appropriate youth-based curriculum options, and of course the media pilot that was mentioned in the LC will be braided into this work, and we look forward to collaborating with the OLCC on that work. Marijuana use, attitudes, health, and effects in Oregon. This is really the bread and butter of what we do in public health. As a part of our role of protecting public health, we have a role in knowing what key information about population health of marijuana use we can identify and the health impacts that may occur from legal marijuana sales in the state. This is similar to the work that we do in other public health areas, like the monitoring that we do around tobacco use, obesity prevalence, and disease rates. And we've developed a key report that will be out later this week that will have public health information around marijuana use. So we'll have information on youth and adult use, as well as attitudes toward marijuana use. This report will give us data to compare to in future years so that we can monitor trends over time in our state and can identify where action is needed. So we know, for example, from the baseline that about half of Oregon adults report ever using marijuana, so the number is about 45%. 1 in 10 report past use in the last 30 days, and the highest use is among young adults aged 18 to 24. There's about 18% of that age group that use marijuana currently. We also know that about 20% of 11th graders, 1 in 5, smoke marijuana currently, and 62% of 11th graders report marijuana is easier to get than cigarettes. So it's going to be important for us to monitor changes in these trends over time to see how the state may be affected. So rulemaking, I'm now going to turn it over to Andre, who will talk about our regulatory work in this area.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Andre Uso. I'm the Senior Manager for the Medical Marijuana Program in Public Health. As part of our role in regulating medical marijuana, OHA has been engaged in rulemaking since the summer of 2015. Deputy Director Lewis provided detailed information on rulemaking to this committee back in November. As she mentioned previously, we have established a standing rules advisory committee that includes representatives from growers, processors, dispensaries, cardholders, public health, and the medical community and general public. This rules advisory committee has completed this work on new rules for regulating grow sites and processors. Public hearings for those rules have been scheduled for later this month across the state. The committee will continue to work with us for over the next few months as we make the current temporary rules for labeling, serving size, and concentration and laboratory testing permanent.
So I, in the interest of making sure we can hear from everyone, if you could deliver your remarks in the next minute or two and then have time for questions, that would be great. Thanks.
Okay, so I'll just go as quickly as possible here, Madam Chair. We did come up with a universal symbol. This was tested over 20 different symbols over several focus groups, and this is essentially what we came up with. Communicates that there's marijuana in the product to both English and non-English speaking audiences. We are currently have received 22 applications from labs for lab accreditation at this point. Dispensary sales to the public, this would be early retail sales. Currently 309 out of 404 registered dispensaries are engaging in early retail sales. That's approximately 76%. Dispensary applications and renewals usually peak in spring and summer. We've seen that again in 2015, and the renewals are on pace, and we don't see a decline through the fall of 2016.
So our sort of the public health considerations or concerns, we continue to be concerned about youth initiation. There's substantial marketing and advertising of marijuana products in the state currently. We know this has a direct impact on youth attitudes and initiation. We have examples from other public health data that tells us that youth smoke and drink, the highest advertised brands. So we don't know why that would be any different for marijuana. Quality of patient care, we need clinical guidelines for physicians who recommend marijuana use for registered card applicants. We also need to look closely at the ratio of patient to caregivers. And additionally, because of our limited ability to track marijuana products on the medical side, finding effective products during product outbreak may be difficult. Finally, we remain concerned that the lack of robust tracking on the medical side continues to put the state at risk of violating the third priority of the Cole memo related to diversion of medical products into the black market. So that is, in summary.
Thank you. Any questions? I know the Senator Farioli has one percolating, but others too. And then Representative Buckley, and then Senator Pervazzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you could go back to the slide showing cardholder. So anecdotally, at least, I've heard that we're about over 80,000 cardholders in Oregon. Have you got a sense, Madam Chair, for what that number actually is?
It's approximately 78,000.
Okay. And can you give me some idea of how many of the dispensaries have indicated to you that they will migrate to the recreational side, and how many have told you that they will remain exclusively in the medical side?
So much like OLCC, we don't have a good number to give you. The best indicator we have is that 75% of our dispensaries are participating in Early Start. So about a quarter of them are not participating in Early Start. Whether or not that's going to be an indicator that a quarter would remain solely medical, we don't know yet, but that's the best number that we have.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'd like to suggest a survey of your members, if that would be possible, email, mail, mm-hmm. snail mail. I don't care how you do it. But my concern is that, as it's always been, is that you're going to see a tremendous migration from the medical dispensaries to the recreational side. And, you know, we're in danger of having approximately 80,000 cardholders who are inadequately supplied by medical-only dispensaries, and so that puts, at least in my opinion, a lot more emphasis on the idea of co-locating medical facilities with recreational facilities so that at least there will be an adequate number of outlets where people could obtain medicine if they were licensed to do so, if they had a medical marijuana card. I guess I envision something that would put much of the medical product beyond the reach of recreational consumers, and the gateway would be the control on the location of those products, and the access would be the card. But that's why I've been pursuing this question about co-location so vigorously over the last, it seems like forever. But I really do think we need to know where the dispensaries will be located, and I fear that many of them will simply migrate to the recreational only, where the cash flow is, and we are going to be reversing the expectation of OMP patients who were told during the Measure 91 debate that their program would not be effective. We've awfully blown the doors off that issue. But I want to make sure that we don't have people stranded who are medically needy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Co-Chair Burdick, I'm going to give you the co-chair's prerogative to jump in, and then we're going to go to Representative Buckley and then Senator Przanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize for having to leave the room for a second. This might have been answered, but there has been an increase in cardholders, and I'm wondering what your why that's happening from your perspective.
We do know that there has been an increase, or there's actually been no decline, so we're keeping pace, and renewals are keeping pace. I don't have a good answer for you today on why that might be the case, but I can certainly look into that and get back to you.
I would like to do that for our next meeting to get okay. into this in more depth. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so it sounds like we have the idea of looking into the amount of increase and rationale given, and then also the number of dispensary owners that have expressed intent to or producers under OHA who express intent to migrate over. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Gentlemen, what's the timeline for the licensing of laboratories?
Our laboratories will be accredited and operating in by June of this year.
Thank you.
Okay, and Senator Przanski.
Thank you. And first to Co-Chair Burdick, I'm going to suggest that one of the reasons we're seeing this is the stigma's been taken away for someone to actually get a card who may have wanted a card but was afraid to get into the program before it became legal in 91. Also, I've heard from some physicians that they're more comfortable actually writing script now. And what I just heard OHA just said is that it's not actually going up, it's staying about the same. So we're not seeing a chart. I project that another year to two, we'll see this flush out. Because those people who are in the system now that may have gotten in it to have access to marijuana and have some type of legal cover will no longer need to have that cover because they'll be able to do it recreationally wise. And so I've talked to people across the state, and that's the information I'm getting on that. I'm going to go back to, I think, the concerns OHA's raised. First of all, this program was a direct response to the voters passing 1998, the medical marijuana program. So we've had this program now for, my guess, 16 years. Cole memo came out about 3 years ago, if I remember correctly, maybe 2 years ago. And it seems like we're trying to jump through a lot of hoops very quickly. That doesn't seem like it's really necessary to do what we've done and show and demonstrate to the feds where they've never have come into this state or any other state that requires that has a license or allowed for medical marijuana programs to basically shut them down because they're out of compliance. So please keep that in mind. What I do want to know is where y'all are at now based on the last presentation we got in November with the recommendation of decoupling patients from growers. That tells me that you're basically trying to shut the system down, and I'm trying to figure out how you're looking at what we've said. We want it tracking to be tracking light, different from seed to sell. So please tell us where y'all are at today on tracking.
So we've issued permanent rules that those are the rules that we'll be taking public comment on later this month that involve the tracking requirements that we included in our rules. We believe that we've set tracking standards that match the language of House Bill 3400 and are happy to discuss any specific
concerns.
Why don't
you give us a little overview of what that is, because I'm hearing you think you did what the bill says, but I also know we put stuff in the bill that y'all are doing something completely different. So how did you interpret it?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Senator Przanski, we're asking those people that or dispensaries that transfer medical product to report to us monthly on the amount. That's it.
Thank you.
Okay. We have a number of, that's really helpful. We have a lot of people who've come to provide community member testimony, and since we will be starting the session very soon and we'll continue to get reports from you on sort of the overall status of the OHA OMMP program, unless someone has a burning question they need to ask now,
I want to just follow up on one thing that you just said about regarding getting the tracking for the dispensaries. What, if anything, have you proposed for growers as to what they're going to have to do for tracking?
If they're going to transfer product to a dispensary or processor, they would have to provide that amount to us on a monthly basis.
That's it?
Yes, sir.
Not seed to sell?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. That was really helpful.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate your good work and your attending that very long meeting on Monday. Thank you. All right. So we're going to have our first community member panel. And I'm going to call to the front, please, Amy Margolis, Anthony Johnson, and Anthony Taylor. And the function of the testimony we're having in the next three panels is to speak to the legislative concepts, the draft bills that we're trying to get into shape in this very short period of time before the February session begins. So we have 15 minutes allocated for this panel. We're running a couple of minutes behind, so if you can keep your remarks really focused, we'll be grateful, and have time for questions, too.
I think Anthony Taylor is going to start.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Co-Chairs, committee members, for the record, my name is Anthony Taylor, and I'm the president of Compassionate Oregon, a nonprofit patient advocacy organization. I'm also an infused product manufacturer. I want to thank the committee for their continued work on the path towards a comprehensive cannabis policy for Oregon. I know it hasn't been easy, but we keep trudging forward like good Americans. We have come a long way since we put our first measure to legalize marijuana on the ballot in 1986. In 1988, we adopted the OMA. And in 2012, Oregonians nearly passed an initiative that would have created an Oregon Cannabis Commission, who some continue to believe would have been the preferred path to legalization. In 2013, we added PTSD as a condition for patients and created Oregon's very successful dispensary program. That program has allowed thousands of Oregonians to have safe access to needed medications and provided a much-needed way for growers to get their excess into a regulated supply chain and out of the black market. Efforts in the 2015 session led to the implementation of Measure 91, legalizing marijuana for Oregon and providing the foundation for this new industry. Legislation adopted in the 2015 session also saw a revision of the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, not seen in a decade. Our collective efforts last session, with all its quirks and quibbles, frustrations, and the eye-crossing amount of reading by everybody, established the foundation for a new industry in Oregon that we continue to build on today, and I imagine for many sessions to come. Today's proposed legislation will provide legislative fixes for issues that missed the mark in previous legislation, as well as add other important building blocks we consider necessary to make our medical and legalization program a roadmap to success for other states on the road to ending prohibition for all Americans. We appreciate new language that will allow OLCC licensed producers to also provide for patients. The changes to residency requirements will undoubtedly make things easier for industry and continue to allow medical marijuana patients new to Oregon access to needed medicines. For patients in the initial or renewal process, we're happy to see the re-emphasizing of the 30-day turnaround time for cards and the language allowing those patients access to dispensaries during that waiting period. Behind the scenes, we encourage that the OHA's efforts to develop online application and payment capabilities for applicants in the new database that should help OMMP staff better respond to the needs of patients. I'm also happy to see some attention given to education for children and young adults to minimize initial use by them, and especially thankful for language exempting patients from paying taxes on their medications. We also appreciate language allowing adult use Oregonians limited access to infused products, concentrates, and oils. Changes to post-prison supervision and parole are long overdue, and the open container law will be welcomed by law enforcement. Researchers will be allowed easier access to plant material for research purposes, and the clinical guidelines work group is a step forward in developing reliable dosing guidelines for physicians and patients. The recall language for marijuana-infused products will make it possible for the state to locate the source of a contaminated product should the need arise. I still think, however, that there is confusion in clearly separating the needs of patients and their providers and the needs of the industries. This has led to complex discussion regarding dosage versus serving size, in balancing the needs of high-dose patients and public safety, and in adopting policies that end discrimination in many areas based solely on the use of medical cannabis. I still worry about personal medical information being available for those it shouldn't be or being accidentally disclosed. I continue to worry about Oregonians whose local jurisdictions have been allowed to disregard the vote of the people and put an undue burden on patient access to needed medications in those areas of the state opting out. Finally, I'm still worried and concerned over fears of patients and growers under new plant limits. If I could ask for just one thing, from this committee this session, it is to allow some more time for patients and growers to come into compliance with these new limits. The March 1st effective date is almost insurmountable for patients and growers to come into compliance with. Now, everybody is starting to move towards these limits and beginning to understand how they actually work, but we really could use some more time. It is an area where the line between addressing the Cole memo and the concerns of the patients are being blurred. Limiting plants per address hurts patients, plain and simple. These limits have caused panic among patients currently worried that they will lose their grower and are being forced into using dispensaries few of the sicker patients can afford. The OMMP is already rejecting applications because an applicant's added plant count exceeds the plant limit for designated addresses. This is a problem that could easily be fixed in this legislation by clarifying that plants per address was limited, but that patients per address was not. I have submitted additional testimony showing that nearly 30,000 patients are at risk of losing access to their growers because of these new limits. I also have concerns about those growers transitioning in the commercial market that will leave patients behind. While this new legislation alleviates some of those concerns, I'm not sure what patients at addresses where 50, 60, or 70 patients are being provided for are going to do. That is, this is why it is so important to give this process added time to make the transition. In addition, I have provided a few slides illustrating how we at Compassionate Oregon believe proposed draft rules for OHA under HB 3400 misses the mark in both legislative intent and a basic misunderstanding on the part of OHA as to how their program actually works in practice. Considering there are 11 different, 11 different configurations of gardens currently used by patients and growers, it is not hard to see how that happened. Because of this, it is a complex task to establish an actual single person responsible for a grow site. In addition, these rules continue to perpetuate card stacking. Everyone will be better served when one individual is responsible for a marijuana grow site, and I believe that moving the four patient per card is key to this effort and would encourage the legislature to do so. Thank you, as always, for the opportunity to shed some light on issues we consider important. I do have a really quickly.
And I'm going to ask you, Mr. Taylor, if you can wrap up in the next minute so that we can transition through the panel.
I will. I just wanted to call attention to these slides that I provided that outline both the definitions, the amount of patients that are going to be affected, and the types of gardens that the OHA is confronted with regulating and providing rules for specifically on this.
You know what? Appreciate this. I think we do need to transition on, though, but you've provided some good slides that we have on OLIS and that people should take a look at regarding the kinds of gardens and the effects of this regulation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This really is a complex situation for the OHA to have to sort through, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide it as part of my testimony.
Thank you very much. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Johnson, Chief Petitioner of Measure 91, as well as co-author and director of New Approach Oregon, the PAC responsible for the Measure 91 legalization measure. Thank you very much for your time and work on this important issue. Measure 91 wanted to end treating marijuana penalties as a crime, create jobs, generate revenue, and not have a negative impact upon Oregon medical marijuana patients. I think thanks to the work of this committee, the OLCC, and the success of our Early Start program, thanks to legislation passed last year, I think we definitely are well on our way to creating jobs and generating millions of dollars of revenue for the state. The work to further decrease criminal penalties and expunge offenses, great work as well, probably gives us the best marijuana law in the country, and it's great to see we're going to continue that work, although there's still a few tweaks needed there. I echo many of Anthony Taylor's statements about the impact, negative impact upon many medical marijuana patients in the state. I think that the March 1st deadline that he alluded to, where we have on March 1st, patients and growers have to reduce their plant number limits, but we have early sales to all recreational customers to go until December 31st, provides a gap there that will harm patients and could stifle the success for the early start. So I think a relatively easy fix is to push back the March 1st date on the plant limits to December 31st to coincide with the early start date for the medical marijuana dispensaries. residency requirements for patients. I was glad to see residency requirements for business licenses be removed from the draft. It looks like residency requirement for patients has been put back in. And I understand that there have been concerns about bad actors abusing the system, taking marijuana across state lines, but under the new reporting, potential inspections, and the plant limits that will go into effect, I think that fear really should subside and really should not override the medical need of, you know, about 2,600 patients who have out-of-state addresses in Oregon, or Oregon patients who have out-of-state addresses. It's less than 3.5% of our patients, and many of these patients have cancer, they're undergoing chemotherapy, they have family that live in Oregon, and they come here and get medicine that's provided for them by a grower that they can't access at recreational dispensaries when their card is no longer valid, or even if they could access it, they can't afford it because it costs too much, and they need a grower that will provide that for them because it takes a lot of product to make the oils and tinctures that they need. So I know of several patients who have cancer who live in Utah, Idaho, Washington, other places that come here for their medical treatment. So I urge you not to end residency requirements for all businesses, but keep them for patients. I urge you to reconsider that. Section 23 in the LC 145 that protects patient gardens at six plants from the prohibition from local communities. I think that's a great start, but under the medical program, you get, under the new limits, you get 12 plants in residential areas, 48 outside the residential areas. I think that would be a better parameter for what localities cannot decrease, so that the medical limits that are available statewide are available, are always available in localities for their medical needs. And I think along with the micro grower model that the OLCC looks to implement, I think additionally having an increased canopy limit both for the micro growers and for OLCC growers who do provide for patients would provide a great incentive for people to still take care of patients and allow that excess with patient agreements to be sold into the regulated system, so that growers keep an interest and keep an incentive to provide for our sickest and most vulnerable patients. And finally, to provide enough time for questions on the panelists, I do believe I caught one increased punishment under the criminal penalties in the LC 145, and that is the possession of, say, 1 gram of an unlicensed extract. Under Measure 91, that would be a misdemeanor. This version bumps that up to Class C felony. So I think if somebody unknowingly possesses half of a gram of unlicensed extract, I think a Class C felony is a little too much for something that's really minor. And the voters passed, small amounts like that should be a misdemeanor. So I'd encourage you to bring that down to misdemeanor, not a Class C felony.
Can you give us a section on that?
Yeah, page 47, you look at lines 8 through 13 on LC 145.
Thank you.
And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions and open up to the rest of the panel.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Ms. Margolis.
Thank you, Chair Leininger, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Amy Margolis, and I appreciate you allowing me to testify today on behalf of the Oregon Cannabis Association. I am also an attorney at Emerge Law Group, and I will try and keep my testimony extremely short today, as I'm testifying on things I think I have testified previously on, and I'm happy to see the committee moving towards those goals. The first is the residency requirement. I appeared last time for invited testimony and talked about and urged the committee to repeal the residency requirements. And I am pleased to see, and our members are pleased to see, and many of my clients are pleased to see this committee moving forward with removing the residency requirements. We believe that there were unintended consequences when the residency requirements were implemented. I think you can see that we have broad support at this table. We don't always agree with each other, but we happen to agree on this issue. that the residency requirements have proven to be unworkable. And I know Representative Buckley asked us if we had some evidence to support a previous assertion that these residency requirements increase barriers for minorities and women trying to enter this market. And I have located and will provide to the committee, although I haven't uploaded it yet, a 2015 Brookings Institute study that shows that women and minorities face often hurdles so big that they're unable to overcome them in terms of accessing capital. They very often need to look outside of their community, and this applies to people who live in poverty as well. So I will upload that and provide it. So I'm pleased to see that. I'm pleased to see broad support, and this is a huge benefit to the industry, including small farmers and processors. The expanded access concept. Again, I think I heard broad support at this table for expanded access. And I want to break it down into the three categories, and I'm going to leave wholesale out of it. For dispensaries, it seems to me to be very clear that if you have a market where almost every dispensary, or at least 75% of those dispensaries, are opting to transfer over to the recreational market, that you are hurting patients who rely on dispensaries. And some patients do rely on those dispensaries. So we are hoping, and I can also tell you from a business perspective, that many of our clients, and we have done dozens of applications and are doing dozens and dozens more, that every single dispensary we talk to says, we don't want to have to choose. We care about our patients. We cannot make any money if we are marginalized just to the medical market. So please go and talk to the legislature and ask for this kind of co-location. And again, you have broad support here among all three of us at this table to move that concept forward. And it is the same issue for cultivators and processors, although that is more of a administrative nightmare for them. So many of our growers and our processors want to provide for both markets. And if you wanted to provide to both medical patients who you care about and the adult use market, you would have to have two regulatory authorities, two tracking systems. And if you're a processor, you do have to have seed to sale tracking under the Oregon Health Authority. You would have to have two license costs. And more importantly, you would have to have two facilities to do that. And it is, I think I can go as far to say, it begins to feel punitive to those who want to continue in the medical market and to those who want to provide medicine to both the medical market and the recreational market. This is a move that helps patients, and it's a move that helps this industry grow as it should. I am in support, and the association is in support of the early sales of edibles and extracts. I know that it is in the LC, and we are in support not only because we can see that market slowly dying right now, and we can. They cannot. Edibles and concentrates and extracts producers are not able to supply recreational users, and they are struggling to survive, which is what we knew was going to happen with growers if we didn't allow for early sales. But even more importantly, the public health piece, the testing labs, and the regulations have caught up to edibles and to oil producers. So you have public health, and you have helping the market, and that will benefit everybody. And finally, I want to talk about figuring out some way to move that March 1st date back some. And our association is coming from a little bit different perspective, but again, you're hearing a number of shades of this from everyone at the table. For our clients and for our members, what you're seeing, many of them who are transferring to the recreational market, is that they have to reduce their plant count, wait for their license, and then ramp back up. And from a pure process perspective, it doesn't make any sense. So we are asking the legislature to allow the OLCC to individually stay the pushback. And I'm going to use the word stay. We could use a number of different words. Stay the pushback date, stay the March 1st date until people are able to obtain their OLCC license. Again, for us, this is a process and procedural issue and not necessarily anything else, but we're asking for it to make sense. Thank you for your time. I'm excited to see such a broad coalition of people supporting these bills, and I think every single one of them is right.
Thank you. Do we have questions for this panel? I know we have two other community panels. Senator Przanski.
To follow, Amy, I think you just said that OHA does, in fact, require seed-to-cell tracking for who?
For processors. So thank you, Madam Co-Chairs, Senator Przanski. I participated and am still participating in the Oregon Health Authority Rules Advisory Committee, and there are two sets of tracking requirements. For growers, the Oregon Health Authority accurately described the once-a-month reporting. For processors, they've put in place a more rigorous seed-to-sale tracking, and it's a barcode system. So, and I asked this question at the Rules Advisory Committee meeting, which is, why are these so different? And the answer was that the Oregon Health Authority believed that the legislature gave statutory direction that growers should have this lesser burden, but that they were free to adopt additional seed-to-sale tracking requirements for processors.
Senator Burdick, did you have a hand?
No, I did, just really quickly, because this idea of the provisional moving back the deadline at the discretion of the OLCC is something that interests me. And I was wondering if you, and I should have asked this to OLCC when they were up here, we'll be talking about this a lot more, but could you see a situation where they did some very basic vetting, like, for example, a background check, some of the very basic requirements for a license in order to get this extension of the deadline? Would you see that as a barrier?
Yeah, co-chairs, Senator Burdick, yes. And I think that my understanding is that the OLCC will be looking at applications, and I've been listening very carefully to them, and I maybe should have a desk next to at least Jesse Sweet, because we talk so often. But I think that they're going to be looking at land use compatibility statements and then background checks. And so that would be the second step in how they evaluate licensure. And if the requirement was hinged on that background check, that really is the first actual affirmative step. And they can correct me if I understood this wrong. That is the first affirmative step they're taking. So after that background check, I don't see any reason why they couldn't allow a stay in those plant count reduction numbers, because that's what triggers the real inspection and practical application of the investigation.
Thank you. Senator Ferriola.
Madam Chair, just a couple things. I think we should, as a committee looking at these revisions, be nimble on the deadlines. The late sales, they weren't early sales, late sales, that actually turns out to be a very positive thing for dispensaries and growers. Otherwise, we heard the downside of not being nimble. So I think that we should comport the dates with the ability of our growers to get licensure. That just makes sense. I'm a bit troubled, no, I'm more than a bit troubled about the idea that not allowing out-of-state purchasers to purchase medical marijuana because they have a card from Oregon. To me, I don't see how that is different than encouraging cross-border sales. So, I have a little difficulty. People can come to Oregon, cannabis tourists, I don't know what you want to call them, people can come to Oregon and buy in a retail setting. And that they're not prohibited from doing that. They should know that returning to their point of origin with marijuana is moving a regulated product, a prohibited product, across the state line. This is at least a federal violation, if not a federal and a state violation, depending on where they're coming from. But people, let them beware. We're going to assume that they can calculate their own risks and the downsides of that violation. But for Oregon physicians to provide a medical marijuana card to an out-of-state resident whom they realize will come back to Oregon to make those purchases makes it a state-sanctioned export of marijuana to out-of-state. It's a whole different animal. And I think that puts, I think those, I don't want to be discompassionate to people that are suffering, but the fact of the matter is we're not authorized to license Idahoans and Californians to access the medical marijuana system in Oregon. So if we are allowing people to get medical marijuana cards that are clearly not Oregon state residents, I don't see that's any different than promoting cross-border sales and giving it a state sanction. So that's a problem. I toss it back to the industry for a rational solution. I don't want to be discompassionate, but I also don't want to put OHA or any state agency in the position of providing, you know, the color of authority for cross-border sales of marijuana. When we don't have it, we can't confer it, and the citizens of other states should know what they're doing. You know, they can come here and partake recreationally, but it's far different for the, literally for the Oregon Health Authority to issue a card to allow somebody to do that. That's, for me, that's just it's a state-sanctioned cross-border sale. That gets us in hot water with the Cole Amendment.
Okay. Thank you for that comment. And Senator Pozanski, I think, has a follow-up to that.
I think from what Senator Farioli, I thought what we had decided in our last set of bills that we dealt in 2015 is actually take away the ability for someone who is out-of-state residents to get a Oregon card. And if that's the case, my understanding, I thought these families that have been testified, they actually are relocating to the state to actually provide those medical services and opportunities so that they are, I mean, I agree, because what we said is, remember, we had that situation down in California, 130 individuals, and that's what I thought we were stopping. And so I know that there's an issue. We are working on the residency that, again, here's OHA saying you're going to have to be a resident of the state for 2 years to be able to be a patient in the state. And that was never our intention. And it's basically we have stuff that I understand is going to be worked on that we're going to be looking at during the session to adjust that and kind of focus them, again, as to what they're supposed to be doing versus their wild interpretations.
So thank you for that comment. I just want to make an observation that I'm seeing some head shakes by OHA personnel in the room on the issue of whether they require 2 years of residency in order to qualify for a medical card as an OMMP program card holder. Am I correct? Do you want to come up and address that, or is that an accurate understanding that you do not require 2 years of residency to get a medical card? I think the issue on the table that I heard a couple of these folks testify to is whether people who do not live in Oregon but who come to Oregon and would like to have Oregon medical cards are eligible to receive them, should be eligible to receive them. And the status of the law, I think people in the room maybe know that I think as of March 1, that's no longer an option. So the settled law that we passed last session is that while it had previously been the case, the law we passed last session dictates that as of March 1, it will no longer be the case. And there are some people in the community who are asking us to revisit that decision. I am not hearing on our panel an appetite for that. But Senator Prozanski, you had another comment, and then we're going to transition, I think, to the next panel.
Amy, this goes back to what you're saying about the dates and knowing the March date. I'm wondering if it wouldn't be more simple to just pick another date in the future, such as the end of the year. Once we know that the full system's up and running to allow for that transition, it seems to me it would be clearer to have everyone knowing on this date everyone has to be in these compliances, and that's what we're trying to do with the March 1 date. It's just now I think we're realizing we're pushing so much so quickly, we just can't make it happen without having these unintended consequences. So if we had whatever that fixed date in the future, and it seems to me it should be able to be done no later than December 31 of this year, because everyone should be up and running at that point. Would that be amenable?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozanski, I am flexible in the process that this committee chooses to use to get to that place. I'm mostly advocating to make sure that the practical application of that date makes sense and is procedurally sound. So I am flexible in the way this committee approaches it, as long as we don't see a crazy application.
Could you come back with maybe some other fixed dates that the industry thinks could do that, as compared to having just wait until this person's license has been approved? Because it just seems like then you got this piecemeal for enforcement, and it seems to me a bright line. If it's not then, September 1, whatever date that might be.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, sir.
If I may, we've always advocated to push it back to the first of next year.
Yeah.
And it's more about patients, frankly, than industry, because all these patients are trying to come into compliance as their growers move towards the new limits. I'd also just like to make a quick point about the reporting required by patients and growers under the new proposed draft rules by the OHA. We have a situation where a patient growing for themselves and three other patients that designate them to grow that's selling excess into the medical marijuana dispensary program will now become a medical marijuana producer and will be required to meet water rights, enhanced security situations, reporting and record keeping, and a number of other items that I don't think was the committee's intention to apply to these 1, 2, 3, and 4 card patients. And I think it's really a critical situation that we have to really make sure that patients aren't overburdened by these sorts of things, because the new definition makes a person responsible. Anybody that lists themselves or somebody else as a grower on their application becomes a person responsible for a medical grow site, and the subsequent requirements under report for reporting and tracking and security make that an onerous burden on the 1 and 2 and the 12 plant and under addresses. And I just think it's an important consideration for patients.
You,
Madam Co-Chair,
Anthony Johnson, you have
60 seconds.
Very quick comment, and then we're going to discuss.
Great. Thank you so much, Madam Co-Chair, member of the committee. To piggyback off Anthony Taylor's last statement, I think if you look at House Bill 3400, Section 80, page 31, are the definitions that the possible inspections and the reporting requirements were not supposed to apply to patients like only grown for themselves or grown for their spouse under 12 plants. And I believe under the draft rules, Oregon Health Authority is going to impose reporting and possible inspections even on a patient only grown for themselves. So I think that's something that may need to be addressed legislatively if that occurs.
Oh, thank you so much for that. I want to note that I'm seeing again some head shakes among the OHA staff in the room. I think there's been a lot of staff transition at OHA, and we are really happy to have the team that we have in place now, and I think that they're acting in good faith. It seems like there may be a fair amount of miscommunication about what the rules are and what people think the rules are, and I would suggest a really robust effort to share information back and forth, because you're all reasonable people. The OHA people I've been working with seem like they're reasonable, well-intentioned. I know you three well, and you're very reasonable. And I bet we can get some of this addressed at an agency level. But I sure appreciate you ventilating the issue today. And with that, thank you for being up here and for your help crafting the and supporting the residency and the expanded access programs to try to make them workable. We next have we have two more community panels. First, Mowgli Holmes, Leah Maurer, and Brent Kenyon, and that will be followed by a panel of local government folks, Rob Bovet and Scott Winkles. Just a preview for the rest of the folks, we have then a preview by Representative Wilson and Representative Buckley of some hemp concepts they're looking at, and then finally an informational meeting on appropriately protective health standards. So welcome. Thank you so much for being here. You may begin in any order.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brent Kenyon. I own Southern Oregon Alternative Medicine. I've been working with medical marijuana patients in Oregon for the duration of the program. I worked in the early days in California in 1995 through my mother having breast cancer twice and researching into what they had put together in some of the early medical marijuana issues. Over the last 16 years, we've done a lot of work to protect and expand what patients can do in Oregon. And at this point, you know, I want to thank you all for your interest in preserving those years of protecting some of the sickest members of our society. And in that, the folks that provide for them, the growers. So some of the things I'm going to quickly comment on, and I try not to repeat what some of my colleagues have gone over. I echo much of what you've heard so far. So I'll just quickly kind of run through things that are on my mind from what we've been reading. initially working on, and a lot of you heard from me before at the beginning of last session, about co-location and how important it is to allow growers to continue to take care of their patients and also potentially be part of a financial lucrative market and recreational grows. And so we're finally seeing that, and I thank you for realizing how important this issue is. And part what I would say comment-wise on that, I think it's great. I think we need to move forward on this. One thing that concerns me, and Senator Prezansky and Ferrioli have both commented on this, is that there is going to be a large migration of folks that move to recreational markets, and patients are going to be in the lurch. And so that was part of being able to co-locate gardens, and so the incentive would be there to continue to care for your patients as well as move forward and be able to make money. One concern that I have is realizing that the majority of the medical stores, and I can tell you the disconnection between, and no disrespect meant to OHA, but the disconnection from patients, growers, what really happens on the ground, and what OMMP program is aware of and deals with is very far apart. I have had the pleasure of working with thousands of folks. We have we deal with the majority of medical marijuana patients in the state through over 16 locations where we have set up full health care, not just medical marijuana cards, but we actually bring people back into the system of preventative health care and continuing to take care of themselves. And part of that being there is going to be only a few stores left, and there's a majority, not a majority, but a large group of growers that would like to stay medical and don't necessarily want to get into the new recreational system. So my fear is if we allow part of this would allow the opt-in folks or the extended privileges, or we've got a few references to this, but basically if you opted into OLCC's system under this, it would allow you to also sell back into the medical-only stores that are still around. My concern with that is there's going to be very few of those folks around, and that's the reality. I can tell you I own three dispensaries, and before the early rollout, we were not doing well financially, and there's not enough patients in the state to make it lucrative enough to continue to care for those folks without the rec sales. Now, perhaps, if we get it right and don't allow people that opt into the rec system to go then back and sell to those few stores that are going to be left, there will be plenty of growers that stay in the medical system that will be able to provide for those stores. So there's no need to allow the big dogs, if you excuse the reference, that are getting into the larger recreational marketplace. There's going to be hundreds, if not thousands, of stores eventually where they'll be able to sell their products. So what I think we need to do is omit the section that would allow those folks that opt into the OLCC. Once you're with OLCC, I would suggest that you're not able to sell back into that small marketplace and allow those small family farmers from Southern Oregon and around the state to continue to have a small family business that can provide for sick patients through those stores. And the next point on that, one of the things we talked about was card stacking. This is an issue that continues to come up. You heard from Anthony Taylor about this earlier. We need to stop saying that somebody can grow for a patient at an address, but you can only have four of those people that you're responsible for, including yourself if you're a patient, but you can have eight patients total on your farm. It seems silly to have other people related to any industry or production where a state authority or someone cannot easily find out who's responsible for that particular grow site. And so the card stacking issue just needs to simply be reversed, that the person that grows there, be it 48 cards at eight patients, you should be able to have all eight patients in your name if you're the grower. For years, this has caused conflicts. People don't know. People make their patient the grower to get through this loophole. And I just kind of continue to see this happening. And I would love to see that addressed now. And it's going to make it easier for all those folks involved to find out who's doing what, and we'll know accurately. I want to say that I am opposed to the residency stuff. I think it did have some negative aspects of what was going on up to this point. We're seeing a lot. There are a lot of snowbirds and folks that come back and forth that do live here part-time and may live somewhere else. I understand the worry of cannabis leaving the area and potentially going somewhere else, which brings up the reciprocity issue, where in California you actually will be left alone if law enforcement pulls you over and you have an Oregon medical marijuana card, and you have cannabis on you. So I think that we should also respect other states that come here that have a medical marijuana card for another state, and let them have access, safe access to their medicine in our facilities, and also, you know, law enforcement would recognize those folks.
Thank you. If you could wrap up in about the next minute, that'd be great.
I can do that. So we'll just go through. So early edible sales, definitely supportive of that. I think that people are going to learn in the long run that a pint of whiskey is different than a pint of beer. And so the fear that someone is going to, the recreational users are going to have damage or you know, get too much of this product, eventually people are going to have to learn. It's further education. OLCC and other organizations are working on that, so I think the education will solve that piece. I would just like to echo the fact that that personally dealing with the patients, and I'm vetting these phone calls at several locations of folks that just have no idea what's happening by March 1. There's a majority of the growers right now have no idea what they're supposed to be doing. They're calling us, asking us. It's difficult to get those answers from OHA at times, and simply mailing things out is not solving the problem. So I would echo that we absolutely need to roll the date back and give people more time to comply so we don't hurt those growers and those patients that are involved in the program up till now. Thank you again for your allowing me to participate and taking input from the industry. We have been doing this a long time, and we're trying to get from point A to point B, but you guys have all been very good on it. I want to thank you again for your continued efforts.
Thank you very much.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, my name is Leah Maurer. I'm here today representing the Portland Women Grow chapter that I helped launch and now serve as a chair for myself. I'm also here as a mother of three young boys and representing parent committees. In fact, I have to leave the meeting a little early to hightail it back to Portland to run a PTA meeting tonight. So I would like to echo what you've heard a lot from both Brent and the panel before us in when we talk about treating the legal cannabis sector just as any other legal sector, that myself and as representing the chapter that I'm here for, we firmly support elimination of residency requirements, and we also should definitely allow co-location for convenience and also for access for patients. However, primarily what I'm going to talk about today is the addition to LC 145 regarding the pilot project in terms of prevention. I think that legalization needs to walk hand in hand with drug education and prevention. I think this is a really, really essential addition to everything that we're rolling out here in Oregon right now. I think that it's super important that we have, I would commend the OHA and the OLCC, first of all, for, you know, putting forth the effort to do this, because I do think it's incredibly important that it's evidence-based, that it's validated, and I would really commend them on working on this. I would encourage the committee to really look closely at this and adopt this part, and I feel that it is just incredibly important that prevention is there for our young people. I think that it's really important also that this is piloted before it's rolled out statewide, and it is really essential that we have a tracking of the outcome, you know, that we have tracking effectiveness, whether it's done by the entity that does it or the state or whatever. I think it's really important that we have a yardstick to measure what the efficacy of the program is. I also would firmly support an increase in the budget for the pilot project, as I feel that this is really essential for rolling this out in a sound way and truly creating Oregon as a model for the rest of the country, like I know all of us want to see happen. I think that people in this sector, you know, need to support that, you know, youth cannabis use prevention that is sensible, and I think that the use of a multimedia campaign is essential in terms of being able to reach everyone, and I would just firmly support everything that this pilot project would go forth and do. So I would encourage you to really look closely at that as a parent and as an industry professional.
Thank you. Mr. Holmes, Dr. Holmes.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, thanks for the chance to speak with you again. I'm going to give you my typical update on the science and public health issues around legalizing marijuana here. There are a few small pressing things that I think need to be done in the short session, but as before, it's mostly good news that we have.
Mr. Holmes, could you introduce yourself for the record,
please? Did I not do that? Sorry. I'm Mowgli Holmes. I'm the Chief Scientific Officer of Phylos Bioscience, and I'm also the chair of the Oregon State Cannabis Research Task Force. So, again, the industry is really grateful to the committee for doing such a good job in the last session. The bills that were passed were thoughtful, and they incorporated more scientific guidance than the corresponding bills in any other states. The OLCC then went on to do a really excellent and thoughtful job with the rulemaking. And I can now report that the OHA, who has now been given the responsibility for the rulemaking process regarding the scientific and public health aspects that have to do with dosage and labeling and serving size and testing and laboratories, the OHA is also doing, I think, a really incredible job of being thoughtful and responsible with its rulemaking process. And that is still ongoing, and there are a lot of really difficult things to sort out in that process, but I think we're on track. One thing that they did recently is address the pesticide issue. So Oregon should be really proud of the fact that in a few months it's going to be the only state of all the states that have any kind of cannabis program in the country that has professional accredited laboratories testing cannabis, and it's also going to be the only state in the country that's testing cannabis for pesticides. That's a really huge step. And the OHA just recently passed an emergency rule that partially accelerates that pesticide testing program. When we did early start last October and we started selling flowers recreationally, it was a little nerve-wracking because we had no testing in place, but the health and safety issues around cannabis flowers are not that severe. They are severe when it comes to pesticides in the pipeline that leads to concentrates, as we've talked about before. Allowing concentrates and edibles made with those concentrates to be sold now before the labs are fully up and ready to do testing could potentially be a problem, but I would say that it's actually going to be okay. Because of the accelerated timeline that the OHA put in place for beginning to test pesticides, which I think they did just because it was the right thing to do, not with this early edibles start in mind. But it's just fortuitous. It gives me comfort to support the early start of edibles sales because we will be testing for pesticides at that point. So I think that's good for the industry. I think it's going to be safe to do. Okay. There's also so the agencies are responsible for dealing with the public health issues around things like pesticides and contaminants and all of that. The OHA is also going to be responsible for giving clinicians guidelines if this bill passes. There's a clinical work group established in this bill that will be housed at the OHA and will be really critical in giving Oregon physicians guidelines on how to prescribe medical marijuana. It's a great idea. The problem with it and with the other responsibilities of the agencies to protect public health and safety is that the basic research that we need to do those jobs and that the agencies need to do those jobs is just lacking. We don't have that research. So that clinical work group will be useful, but they will spend a lot of their time sitting around and taking note of the fact that there's no research to guide them. The same is really true for the OHA as it goes about finalizing its testing rules. And even though we went through a legislative process and then a rules process at the OLCC and now another really detailed one at the OHA, we still don't know exactly what the testing rules should be because we don't have a lot of the basic research that we need. And for the clinical side, we still don't know a vast number of things. So the Cannabis Research Task Force has been given the job of figuring out how to address some of those issues so that the state has the information it needs to run the industry properly and doctors have the information they need to prescribe intelligently. I'll be back here, I guess, in February with the recommendation from that task force. I can tell you now we're going to recommend, I hope, a number of different things that will increase the ability of universities to do important medical research, and also some kind of probably a body separate from the university system that can do all of this public health research that's necessary, that the state needs, but that for various technical reasons can't actually be done at universities that are dependent on federal funding. I recognize it's probably too tight in the short session to have any results of the task force result in legislation. But before I wrap up, I want to say that we have a mini version of that that we have talked to legislators about this session. We have asked for the legislature to fund a small study to be done by an independent environmental engineering firm here that would just do a basic survey of the cannabis in Oregon. This is the kind of study you can't do at universities. There's not even a pathway to do it. You have to use NIDA marijuana to do any plant research at universities. So by definition, you can't study Oregon marijuana. With a really brief surveillance study, we could figure out if there are heavy metals in cannabis. We don't know. We could figure out how much E. coli there is on cannabis. We're recommending testing for it, but we are just using educated guesses when we set the threshold. So Oregon is on the edge of being the most evidence-based, the most science-driven cannabis program in the whole country. I mean, it already is. With things to enable research in the state, I guess next session, it will be at the forefront of Oregon, of national research. But if we can do a little bit in this session, if we can find some way to enable some tiny bit of research that makes sure that our testing guidelines are really rational and science-based, I think we're going to look up and find that we're doing almost everything right, which is great. Surprising.
But not that surprising. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's great. I really appreciate your being here. And from what I am understanding, there's a chance that you'll come forward, that the group will be ready to have a modest request to the legislature this session, possibly not, but possibly yes, and we'll wait to hear if that is coming. We're actually kind of out of time right now, so members of the committee, does anyone have a burning question you'd like to ask right now? Representative Olson? Are you sure you don't?
Affirmative.
Okay. All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for taking the time and waiting. And we look forward to hearing more about this concept when you're ready to talk to us about a specific proposal. And thank you for coming all the way up from Southern and down from Portland. All right. We have 45 minutes left. We have three more panels. We're running a little bit tight. Right now, I'd like to invite Rob Bovet and Scott Winkles to come forward to offer local government perspective on the two bills, the committee bills, which is really the narrow thing that we're trying to focus on. And then we're going to invite Representative Buckley and Wilson. We're going to introduce the committee bills. Then we're going to invite Representatives Buckley and Wilson to make some comments and then have a final panel on health standards. So, gentlemen, welcome.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, Legal Counsel, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be incredibly brief because I know you're pressed for time. Just have a few things to point out. First, just for the record, I provided an updated map, no PowerPoint today, just an updated single-page map of counties and the decisions they've made with regard to time, place, and manner, land use, opt-out, elections, various things. A couple things to note just of interest. Three of the far eastern Oregon counties that could act under Section 133, essentially opting out of marijuana businesses without an election, actually chose to call for an election, interestingly enough. Deschutes County has an opt-out with an election, but they've already announced they intend to repeal that and replace that with time, place, and manner and land use regulations. So I appreciate Section 20 of this bill. I believe they have the right to repeal the opt-out ordinances, but Section 20 will keep them out of court if somebody wants to challenge that. So I appreciate that as well. I've been working with Senator Pruszynski as well as Representative Olson on some further offense reductions even beyond what's in LC 145. So I've got some tune-ups to those. I've also heard the testimony from today. So I'll be crafting some further revisions to LC 145 by way of amendment that I'll get to Mark, hopefully within a week, so we can get that processed and ready for you to look at. I'm going to try a third time to rewrite the open container provision to substantially narrow it, not model it on alcohol, look closer to what Colorado and Washington have on their books. I'll give a third crack at it and get it to Mark here within a week. I've got a series of technical amendments, four of which I shared with the co-chairs yesterday. I won't bore you with any of that stuff. They're very dry and technical, and like Mark, skipped all of his technical conforming amendments. I'll skip that unless you want me to get into it. Finally, I'll just mention Section 38. Which would permit parolees from prison as well as those that are on post-prison supervision to utilize medical marijuana and prohibit any condition that would preclude that. AOC doesn't have a position on that yet. I've referred that to the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the Community Corrections Directors for their review. I kind of have a feeling where they're at on it. I could be wrong. But I'll report that back to you in January after those two entities have gotten back to me, because they're the ones that have to administer this and have to deal with people on post-prison supervision and whether or not allowing them all across the board to have medical marijuana would be a good idea or not. So with that, I'll defer to my colleague.
Thank you.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles. When I'm with the League of Oregon Cities, I will be even shorter, briefer. On regards to LC 145, there are three points I would like to highlight that we are supportive of. One, it creates a there was an omission in the land use piece, and it created a added a city-related land use statute that had we had intended in the draft at 3400. That's in. It's adding 227. That creates gives us the same rights as the counties do when it comes to the LUCs and the land use issues. Additionally, the clean opt-in provision makes sense. I've already had a city that has opted out ask me how they could opt back in, they would like to do that in a way that is as clean as possible, and doing that in a way that isn't going to prompt a litigation is certainly beneficial. And finally, the bill would allow for cities to enter into an IGA, an intergovernmental agreement with the Department of Revenue for the collection of the taxes, for the local taxes. So now it's the marijuana business would only pay DOR instead of having to pay DOR and then pay the city. And so we think that's an efficiency for everybody. We like, in regards to LC 180, I will confess I don't completely understand it or some of the issues around it. I know from sitting in the groups that there are patients who are concerned about access. I think they're probably right that there will be patients that will not have access. And we would like to study. I'm going to continue to study that, and we have a meeting on the calendar with Madam Co-Chair to discuss this further. And with that, I'm done.
Excellent. Anybody have questions for this panel? We sure appreciate your engagement and ideas on all the issues. You've been both really helpful to us as we've worked to move forward, so thank you. And we'll look forward to your additional set of proposals. Thank you. All right. Thank you for being here. And with that, I will ask for a motion. I'm going to actually open a work session. introduction of committee bills.
Chair Leininger, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 145, dated January 13, 2016, and LC 180, dated January 12, 2016.
Vice Chair Wilson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 145, dated January 13, 2016, and LC 180, dated January 12, 2016. Is there any discussion? All right, so if there are no objections, these measures are introduced as committee bills. And now we will transition to an informational meeting on the hemp concept. So I'm going to open an informational meeting. on two hemp concepts that our colleagues, Representative Buckley and Representative Wilson, are developing. And I will invite Representatives Buckley and Wilson to the table, and also Courtney Moran from the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers. Okay, thanks.
See you when we grill you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature. In the interest of time, I'll be very brief, because what we're trying to do with the proposed amendment is very simple. It's the same thing we were trying to do with the bill at the end of last session. We ran into extraordinary number of problems with the Department of Ag and with Farm Bureau just trying to get to a basic concept. And we'd like to offer an amendment that follows some certain principles. One principle is that the hemp industry is something that I believe that has great support, and we want to see it thrive. The other concept is that the Federal Farm Bill was passed in 2014 and allows states to enter in to the development of industrial hemp industry in their states. The bill attempted last session was simply trying to get us to adhere to the guidelines that were presented by the Federal Farm Bill. There was tremendous difficulty in trying to clarify that. Our federal delegation has written to the Department of Agriculture to try to clarify the requirements of the Federal Farm Bill. So what I'd like to do is offer an amendment to one of our bills in this committee that simply will require the department to adhere to the Federal Farm Bill in the same way that this committee has tried to sincerely adhere to the Cole memo to the best of our ability. It's obvious that hemp can be a tremendously successful crop, successful industry for our state. We want to make sure it gets into place in compliance with the feds, that there is the research requirement that is part of the Federal Farm Bill, and that the people operating within the program have the licensure and the oversight similar to the licensure and oversight of the marijuana program as well. I'd be happy to go into detail on it, but the major provisions are that the Farm Bill says that only institutions of higher education and state departments of ag are used to grow or cultivate industrial hemp, which is why licensure is required, because only the Department of Ag or a institution of higher education can be the umbrella group for the hemp industry. That is why we're trying to get licensure on it. It requires that the sites used for growing or cultivating hemp be certified by and registered with the State Department of Ag. The State Department of Ag was not doing that until we brought pressure on them through the bill last session. They are now going to do it. They've kind of pulled back, and they are clearly certifying the sites where hemp is being grown. And again, I don't want to overcomplicate it. I think the principle is very simple. The cannabis industry, the marijuana industry, and the hemp industry can coexist side by side. They can both thrive. I just think we have to do it in an intelligent way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excellent. Thank you. I am going to invite Representative – well, actually, before we transition to the next bill, does anyone have questions about this amendment in particular? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, does it certify, using that word, is it certify or register, really just recognizing where it is there something in the certification that they have to do?
It says certified by and registered with the State Department of Agriculture.
What are they certifying?
They have to basically, we're talking about the site, not the grower, but the site. So the Department of Ag has to know where hemp is being grown. And there's the provision of the bill that regards the THC level that's acceptable. So the ability of the department to test to make sure that THC level requirements are kept to is part of the form of the Federal Farm Act.
Curious.
Any other questions about this?
Just clarification.
Yes, sir.
The current law does require them to actually give the points of where where they're growing, so I'm not sure how much difference this is really going to be. I think it's just continuation of what their requirement is and knowing where the fields are, because that's how we set it up back in 2009.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. And then Representative Wilson, I'd love to invite you to introduce your bill, and then Ms. Moran, if you would like to offer some comments, we would love to hear from you.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chairs. For the record, Carl Wilson, State Representative, District 3, Grants Pass, Josephine County. I don't know what I'm talking about, so I'm going to I would really admonish all of my other colleagues to follow the same creed. I want to talk a little bit about an LC. It's LC 232. We realize that hemp has a gigantic upside here in Oregon. We also understand that it needs to coexist peacefully with the marijuana industry. To that end, we want to go back and reflect on what happened on hemp in the last session. We didn't emerge with anything. Maybe that was good. We're going to approach it, I think, in a better way this time around. So we're looking for things such as cultivation flexibility to open up the opportunities to for this product to really become something that is valuable. We're talking about testing, bringing testing. We discovered before in the previous hemp program that nearly everyone was growing CDBs and not so much for seed and for fiber. So we want to begin to have law conform with reality. Also, registration, bringing that forward as well. We have some things that we're planning on amending already as we look at this LC, but I'd like to go ahead and take this opportunity to hand it over to an expert who understands exactly what we're doing. If I have anything here, I have great excitement and exuberance about this product and what it can do. And so I plan to devote myself to learning a whole lot more about this product and what it can do. But with nothing further to say, I'm going to turn it over to Courtney Moran.
Thank you. Welcome.
Madam Co-Chairs, Committee, I'm Courtney Moran. I'm a cannabis attorney. I represent all aspects of cannabis, whether it's medical, recreational, or industrial hemp, and I am a lobbyist for the Oregon Industrial Hemp Farmers Association. I'm not sure how much time I have, but I'd like to begin with talking about...
Back off the mic.
Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry. But talking about the true difference between industrial hemp and marijuana, and that is psychoactivity or the intoxicating threshold. Now, while we are in a current state where our industrial hemp and marijuana is distinguished by a 0.3% THC, and we are maintaining that right now, and that's what the federal farm bill does say, the true scientific difference between industrial hemp and marijuana is the THC to CBD ratio in the plant. So a plant that has a high THC ratio compared to the amount of CBD within the plant, so the percentage of THC to the percentage of CBD within the plant, if it is greater than one, meaning there's more THC than CBD, it is psychoactive and it is marijuana. Whereas if it has less THC than CBD, so a ratio of less than one, it means it is non-psychoactive, and that is industrial hemp. So that's the true distinguishing factor between the two. Now, as Representative Wilson mentioned, we are all about coexistence, and that's what this bill is promoting and protecting. So by allowing the industrial hemp farmers to cultivate in greenhouses and to use clones, transplants, and cuttings, one, this puts it in line with every other agricultural crop in Oregon. Currently, it's the only crop that can only be direct seeded into a field. So this will not only bring it into a line with the rest of the agricultural crops, it will also promote coexistence because farmers will be able to guarantee their genetics by using clones and cuttings. And also, if they are using seeds, they can sex their plants in their greenhouse before they put them in the field. So that really promotes coexistence and reduces any cross-pollination concerns. As he mentioned, a lot of farmers are growing for therapeutic CBD, you know, and because of that, we want to bring industrial hemp in line with the marijuana testing. So right now, what happens is the Department of Agriculture, they go out, they do the inspections, they do the testing in their own lab. What we are advocating for is having these labs that are accredited by the Oregon Health Authority and licensed by OLCC to actually do the testing, and to also have any industrial hemp products intended for human consumption to have mandatory testing in line with the OHA testing for marijuana items. And the other third part is the registration, and I know Representative Buckley's been talking with you about that. Now, the Farm Bill specifically says that sites used for growing or cultivating industrial hemp in a state be certified and registered with the State Department of Agriculture. Changing from a licensing system to a registration system will still maintain compliance with the Farm Bill. And this provision that we have changed from licensing to registration, it still allows the Department of Agriculture to refuse registration. So it's not just a free-for-all. Anyone can register. They still have the right of refusal, right to deny renewals and revoke any registrations. Wow. Yes, so one of the amendments that we would be having to this bill is removing the minimum 2.5 acre requirement. That has been causing a lot of issues with the rulemaking last year and with the Department of Agriculture. Senator Prezanski, I know you and I have discussed removing that provision, as well as I've spoken with Katie Koba and other members at the Department of Agriculture, and they are in agreement that if that is removed, it will alleviate many of the issues that they have been having and will also make it easier on the farmers. The other section we'd be removing is the section about handlers. This is not the time to address that issue. And the third section we'd be removing is section 9-1A. And the reason for that is because on December 18th, President Obama signed into law the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2016. It contains section 763, which prohibits any funding from any federal agency that prohibits the transportation, processing, sale, or use of industrial hemp. So basically, this has opened up the door for interstate commerce in industrial hemp, and this provision just needs to be removed to be in line with the federal law.
Great. Senator Farioli.
I think the possibilities of expansion of the hemp industry are exciting. But here's a question that you don't need to answer for me now, but I would like you perhaps to come back offline or later or in some other format or at our next meeting. If most of the industrial hemp is being used for CBD, that's a pharmacological product. That is a pharmaceutical product. So what's the interface then with OHA?
Sure, I'd love to talk about that right now. So with the Oregon Health Authority, they are only regulating marijuana. And right now, the last draft of their rules that came out says that they will only be allowing CBD derived from marijuana in their dispensaries. So there is no market overlap between the two. OLCC will be allowing industrial hemp products once those retail dispensaries open, but they have to have the same testing, labeling, and packaging as any marijuana item, which our bill also is in line with, as we want the mandatory testing.
Follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If most of the hemp is being grown for CBD currently, what is the market for CBD from hemp?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farioli, the market can be in any traditional marketplace. I've seen it in traditional co-ops up in Portland, and now that this appropriations bill has opened up for interstate commerce, we can just be seeing it used as dietary supplements in any type of market, and that's where they're traditionally being sold.
I'm not referring to seeds. I'm referring to hemp-derived CBD. What is the market for hemp-derived CBD?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Farioli, dietary supplements, and that is what it's being sold as. I've purchased a gram of CBD oil in a co-op.
Under the radar.
Yeah, I was going to say, Madam Chair, that's why I asked the question.
Yes, it's a smart question.
And sorry, just to follow up, Madam Co-Chair, this is why we want the mandatory testing. We want the public consumers to be safe, and that this testing will provide for that.
Interesting. And I see Co-Chair Burdick and Senator Prezanski both have questions. And
can I preempt the follow-up? It's very short.
Sure.
Look, we're struggling with the idea of supplying the medical needs of folks who are primarily dependent on CBD. This could be a huge potential supply for medical users, but currently we have a barrier to the migration of CBDs from hemp into the OHA program. Am I getting it? Is that right?
You are.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Co-Chair Burdick and then Senator Prezanski.
Yeah, I have a technical question. You said that the definition of hemp, the 0.3% or whatever it is not the accurate one. The accurate one is the ratio between the THC and the CBD. What if you have very high THC and very high CBD? Does that still count as hemp?
Madam Co-Chair, there are some scientific studies that put a 1% threshold of THC as the intoxication threshold. Some other studies have shown that CBD actually counteracts the effects of THC. So if you have a ratio of CBD that's higher than THC, it is unlikely for someone to have a psychoactive effect.
Hmm. And then I just had another question. They were selling, I think they're called hemp hearts. Remember I gave you some of those?
What?
Yes, like that. What is the status of those? Are they? How are those regulated? Are those covered under hemp, or will they be under the bill for testing for human consumption? What is the status of those?
Madam Co-Chair, the current status for industrial hemp foods, they are fully legal on federal and state level. They have been clearly legal since 2004 with a case called HIA versus DEA. For our specific bill, any industrial hemp products intended for human consumption would have this mandatory testing, which we support because of the phytoremediation properties in cannabis. Now, the way that the current law is, handlers that are importing from out of state don't have to have the same type of testing, but, you know, these products are being sold on the market. They are tested for THC because otherwise they can't be imported into the country.
But they're not tested for pesticides or any of that?
No, neither is a lot of our other food. That's why we want to set the standard.
Oh, lovely.
All right.
Madam Co-Chairs, members of the committee.
Yes, please.
I do want to add there's a lot of education that has to take place on this subject, because I offered to sprinkle hemp hearts on the salads of a number of my colleagues today over lunch, and they, to a person, refused, believing that they would get high. So,
no.
I've tried it. It doesn't happen.
That's correct.
All right. Representative Buckley, as one of the presenters, did you want to make a comment, and then we're going to go to Senator Przanski?
Yeah, just a quick comment. Just I want to make clear, I support very much of what's in the bill that Representative Wilson is bringing forward. That where we're going to have the disagreement is on the THC level issue, since the Federal Farm Act defines it in one way, and their bill defines it in a different way. So we will have a disagreement on that definition.
Madam Co-Chair, can I interject? We are maintaining the 0.3% in this bill. I just wanted to bring it aware because, I mean, you guys are the Committee on Legalizing Marijuana, and you're working on hemp and marijuana issues. I just think it's important you guys understand the science, not just what the law is regulating.
So before we go to Senator Brzezinski's question, does that address the conflict that you thought there was and now there is
no conflict?
There
was. The other conflict, I believe, will be on the issue of licensure of
versus
growers
registration.
Versus registration.
You know, hopefully the two of you can talk through whether there's a way to get on the same page on that issue. That would sure be a great signal to the committee if that were possible. But it's really interesting. And Senator Przanski, what would you like to add?
It's more of a statement. My understanding is one thing we have to keep in mind. First of all, the research hasn't been done. So we really don't know exactly what and how much CBD versus THC is necessary for the holistic parts and attributes of the plant. And so what we've seen and what I've heard anecdotally is that you can't say that we're going to save the world and just rely on just industrial hemp producing CBD to actually address all these other areas, because there is a mix. And we've heard testimony throughout the previous hearings we had that there is a need to have some type of balance. They don't know why, but THC to some level is important to give the ability for the CBDs to actually do a lot of the attribute or give the attributes it has. So that's, I think, another part of why we're going to be on the cutting edge by having research being done in this state to actually start laying those landmarks.
Yeah. Great. Well, this is really interesting work that you're doing. I'm excited that you presented it to us today, and I look forward to hearing more. Senator Burdick, did you want to make a final comment? Okay, then thank you for being here. We'll look forward to hearing more, and we'll have our final panel of the day. We'll invite forward to discuss appropriately protective health standards Dr. Jeff Raber, John Thompson, and Reagan O'Reilly.
And Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just to make sure the record stays straight, this committee and the legislature did not legalize marijuana in Oregon, and that's not our task. Our task is to implement the legalization that was brought by the citizens of the state of Oregon, not the legislature. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you for that clarification. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being patient.
Madam Co-Chairs and committee, thanks for having us. I'm John Thompson, the general manager and co-owner of the workshop here in Oregon. Reagan is a co-owner. This Dr. Raber is the founder and the chief scientific officer for the whole network of companies that we're involved with. And we'll be here to sort of support and maybe answer some questions. We're going to defer most of the time because we want you to hear the science around the self and safe and healthy stuff, health and safety stuff, primarily around solvent residues and pesticide issues. So
thank you, Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jeff Raber. I have a bachelor's in biochemistry and a PhD in synthetic organic chemistry from the University of Southern California. And I appreciate the opportunity today to provide some information and education. A little background about us. We are a science-based organization. I am the founder. Since 2010, we've been testing medical cannabis in both California, more recently have done it in Washington, and hope to start doing it also in Oregon as well and other states across the country. We have three PhDs, three master's scientists, and a number of bachelor's chemists from world-renowned universities, one including the Leiden University in the Netherlands. Our chief scientific officer is actually from the Netherlands with 8 years of experience in cannabis. Members from Caltech, Los Angeles, USC, Louisiana State, and also Stanford University. We always think science first. So that is the whole position that we come from, using information and resources based on the data that we've collected, other things that we've been able to come about throughout the literature, and take that position to educate the public and members of the legislatures and regulatory bodies across the country. It's really about consumer protection and health and safety of the patients and the consumers who will be consuming these products first and foremost. So we was asked to present today predominantly about solvents, their use, the possible residues left in the end products, and cultivating agents along with their potential hazards and what we should consider when we're addressing laws and regulations about them. Predominantly, I'd say the first and foremost thing is the operators that will be exposed to those. Those are the first individuals who may be exposed to high concentrations, potential flammability, or other volatility hazards in terms of solvents and or cultivating agent exposures. So the concentrations are high when they're dealing with them, much lower in the end products. But you also have to be concerned with what is left in the end product. And that depends on how you operate with those agents and solvents and how you process them and how you end up getting that end product to the market finally. And that then relates to which testing residue limits you would like to set and establish. So understanding which ones are allowed, which ones are not allowed, and which limits should be most sensible for the testing laboratories to go about and detecting those. I think that's typically where the lawmakers and regulators have their biggest challenge, understanding what we should do in that respect. And I should speak a little bit. Some people say, well, can it be easy? Can I point to a federal regulation such as Class 1, Class 2, or Class 3 solvents? Class 1 solvents are highly toxic. Class 2 is a little less, and Class 3 are a lot less toxic. That is a federal regulation by the FDA, and they are used for making life-saving drugs. So it's a very different principle than what we're looking at in terms of cannabis. When you're talking synthetic chemistry, there is a possibility that there's only one way that I could make that life-saving drug, and I might need to use something like benzene or a highly toxic solvent to get the chemistry to work the right way. If that's the case in that regard and you're making a cancer chemotherapeutic agent, then I really need to understand the process. The FDA comes in and looks at exactly what that process is and understands that you've gotten all of the residues of that product out, and there may be that small trade-off in if there's an absolute tiny bit there, it still is worth giving that drug to someone to try and save their life, as opposed to saying there's a trace of benzene in there. That is definitely not the case here with cannabis. We know it's very effective, and we know that we can use a lot of other agents and other chemical methods or approaches to processing these products without the use of solvents such as that type. So a more rational and sensible approach based on what people can use, what's easy to use, safe to handle, we don't have to go to that extreme, and it therefore takes a little bit more thought than just pointing to something that was already established. So in terms of solvents, there are three predominant methods. There are some that use like concentrating methods that use absolutely no solvents whatsoever, silk screening or heat and pressure type methods. Methods that leave no residues behind that are in the chemical sense, those usually typically use water or carbon dioxide. And then solvent-based methods, which you may have heard of, using hydrocarbon solvents or alcohol-based solvents. predominant methods that have been used up to this point, being in the gray or even black markets, have been what could I buy? Could I buy at the hardware store? What could I buy online? What could I have access to? When you have a formally licensed, regulated program, it kind of opens the doors to chemical suppliers who are more willing to give you the high purity products that you would require, the right solvents that you would like to use, and you don't have to just go to the hardware store and get something that would work, like kerosene or something like that. You have much better choices today in today's markets. So a little bit of thought about that makes it a lot easier. What you should understand, the solventless methods are very low hazard to the operator and certainly low hazard to the consumer in the end. They're not going to leave anything behind. But they might not be very scalable or very efficient. They leave very different products as opposed to other types. They might not be as in demand. It's one method to get things done. I'm very much a fan of as many methods as possible, allow for open innovation, let everyone be as creative as possible to find out which diverse product might work for which patient population. We don't know enough about cannabis to say only do this. We really don't understand that and what else we may be limiting. It's very important to add as many options as possible as long as they're safe to the operator and to the consumer. Residue-free methods, when you talk about water, the concern would be, well, is there water left in the product, and could that mold the concentrate in the end? So testing of that product is very sensible in terms of microbiological contaminations. And then did your water have things like heavy metals or other residues and pesticides inside of that? So it may be easiest to test the water going into that process and certify that it's been pure of metals and toxicity problems. And then you can use that and just do a microbiological test on the concentrate when done. CO2 operations, there's the operational concern of high pressure limits, and it could be operated very safely with certified engineered equipment in proper ventilated rooms. OSHA exposure limits in typical states are rather high. We remind everybody, we do exhale carbon dioxide, so it's not that toxic to us, but at large limits it can asphyxiate us and it can offer an operational hazard. So it's important that we operate them in professionally built rooms that are properly ventilated and everybody can understand how that should be done. I believe there's some cleanup language in the current legislation that will fix whether it's in a spark-free room or not. The equipment's not spark-free, so you can't put it in a room that's designated like that. But I believe we've addressed most of those concerns, and they're actually being addressed right now. Solvent-based residues are probably the one of most concern. They're the one in the news most often. We hear about people, unfortunately, you know, blowing up apartment complexes, homes, and other areas. They represent a great deal of operational hazards, high volatility, inflammability, and it's unfortunate that most of the operators are not formally trained in chemistry and the potential hazards. You have a lot of enthusiastic entrepreneurs, I would say, who can see something on the internet, getting partial information but not all the safety information, and end up in a very hazardous environment. Properly certified equipment operated in a closed-loop fashion can be operated very efficiently and professionally, very low operational hazards in a ventilated room with spark-free room conditions. Those can all be built and designed, and I think the regulations speak towards that. And we operate refineries as chemists, and it's very possible to do this at large scale with next to no hazards whatsoever. There is no such thing as zero hazard when you have it around, but you can build them to the place where they are exceptionally low in hazard, and you really eliminate virtually all of those concerns. You have fail safes, pressure safes, and it's really okay to operate in that condition with the right operating conditions, the standard operating procedures, and everybody being properly trained. End product residue limits become a little bit more challenging when you consider solvent use as well as cleaning residues. So I have to clean my equipment and make sure I'm not cross-contaminating. I don't want to mix CBD with THC or vice versa. I want to make sure that every batch of the product material that I get is absolutely going to be what I intended it to be. So it's important to clean my equipment and all of the glassware and other things that I would use in that respect. I think the best approach in this regard is to just deny everything and start with a very limited list, and a list that we know will actually work very well, that we have operational conditions and experience that say that these few solvents are very easily workable with cannabis. They're very efficient and able to be used, but the current list that I've seen produced by Oregon scares the daylights out of me. It has things like hexane, which is known to form a metabolite inside the body, which is very toxic. It allows for benzene, which if a lab has the opportunity to mist for testing that, you could have huge hazards. That's a well-known carcinogen. And methanol, which could be at rather high limits. It's wood alcohol. It's known to cause blindness and could be linked to brain cancer and can burn with a clear flame so that people that are operating it don't even know that it's there. So the current list is far too vast and far too broad. and absolutely not necessary in my chemical opinion. You can do it with a relatively few number of solvents. The eight that we've listed here will give every operator today full abilities to produce every product that they're doing already. It makes it very easy to say if they're at the right purity, if they're at the right grades, I can get access to those. And now I have a very easy job on the labs. They don't have to look for an enormous number of things. And I just don't open the door of Pandora's box by accident saying, hey, I think these are okay, and if you want to go about using it, you know, good luck. I think that that really is not the message that we want to send to everybody, and it's absolutely not necessary.
Dr. Raver, may I jump in?
Sure.
So you are going through a lot of technical information, and I know that you've worked with Senator Przanski on some of the good work that you've been doing. I think it would be really helpful if you could really focus your comments on the things that OHA needs to know or that we need to know, recognizing that OHA is a rulemaking agency, mm-hmm. Because it's the end of a three-hour hearing.
Yeah,
and we want to get as much as we can discern from your good comments. The first thing I'm hearing you say is that we need to really take a close look at the solvents that I believe by OHA rule are on the list of allowable solvents, and your position is that it's a very over-inclusive list right now, and we should
Correct.
Winnow it down to get rid of some dangerous solvents that are unnecessary but are currently included on the list.
Absolutely.
So thing one.
Yep.
And if you could be very direct in your
yep.
suggestions to us without maybe all of the contextual information so that we don't accidentally miss your good suggestions,
sure.
that would be great.
Yep. Limit the list to eight solvents, the eight listed here, propane, butane, pentane, and heptane, absolutely no hexane, ethanol, ethyl acetate, acetone, and isopropanol. Those would be the eight that I would allow. If you allow them at 99% purity or higher, preferably food grade if you can access them in that grade, you will be fine. And then set what we would establish to the safety limits in that rule are also quite high. It's not necessary to set them over a combined limit of 500. So right now, the way the rule is written, I could have 5,000, 5,000, 5,000, 5,000 and end up with basically solvent soup in my product. I don't think that's a really good idea. And that would still pass through and be, you know, able to go and meet the market. A combined limit, all of these solvents totaling up to no more than 500 ppm, completely doable by all the processing standards today. If anyone argues that that's too stringent, they're absolutely wrong. We see people get below one. So it is very possible to have next to virtually non-detectable limits of solvents inside of the products. This is done on a standard routine basis by many now. So those who are complaining just haven't quite adapted yet. 5,000 for each individual one is far too great. And if you're adding each of those on top of themselves, it just stacks up to a very dangerous limit. So a combined limit of 500, if you have one or two, the solvent you used and a cleaning solvent, you're still okay if it's below 500. And that's a very reasonable limit. It's similar to what dietary supplements might have.
Okay.
And these solvents are all able to be used at much greater limits than that already in the rule. That's been deemed safe for most things. So I think we're okay with what you need to understand, and that's what this slide speaks about, is most of these products are inhaled. And inhalation hazards are typically 10 times more greater than oral consumption. So I don't have first pass metabolism of my liver to protect my body. I don't have an absorption barrier in the gut. I actually am inhaling it into the airways, which is like injecting it into the bloodstream. So when the FDA looks at a drug that's orally consumed or one that's via inhalation, the residual limits or the other limits are typically 10 times greater for inhalation because it's so much more sensitive to the body. So that's why you would also move from 5,000 to 500. So there's that factor of 10 going in that fashion. In 2013, we looked at cultivating agents via the use of a mechanical lung. We didn't inhale these ourselves, don't worry. And we actually have a system where we could hook up three different inhalation devices to this mechanical lung that would trap the cultivating agents that we had put onto the plant material. So we understood exactly how much we put on the plant material, combusted it, and inhaled it through the lung like a typical user would at the same rates of inhalation and same volume of air, and determined that up to 70% of those cultivating agents could be transferred into the airways. That is an alarming amount, actually.
Just in case, pesticides are cultivating agents? So he's talking about pesticides on the actual flower at this point.
Yeah, rodenticide, herbicide, fungicide, herbicide, and pesticide, all the sides, basically. So we took four that we had seen pretty commonly used, a broad class of different types of chemical structures to say that this is a pretty general idea. We have no idea what could be inhaled in that fashion if these types of pesticides or cultivating agents could be destroyed in the combustion process, but in fact they are not. So they are directly going to pass into the airways. And that is of great concern if you're going to allow a large list of these types of products that could be amenable towards cultivators to use as well. So again, I think when you're thinking of products that are most often going to be inhaled, not orally consumed, cultivating agents typically have allowable daily intake limits, but those are based on oral consumption. Like we don't combust and inhale lettuce or tomatoes or anything like that. This is a different product in that respects. And tobacco products have done a little bit of study, but they do not have any pesticide limits on them because of strong lobbying efforts, and really they kind of consider that you're going to, you know, kill yourself with tobacco anyway, so it didn't really matter. But it is why they put, you know, this is why they put filters on the end of cigarettes. So okay. They did determine that helps that.
So this is really some wonderful information. We are right pushing up against 5 o'clock.
Can you give me 1 minute?
I'd like to give you 1 minute to make summary statements of takeaway we should take away, and then I'm going to make some summary statements.
The California and Washington have moved to put good regulations in place saying the only cultivating agents that should be allowed are ones that are acceptable in foods with no threshold limits. These are things that we know are so safe that it's really not a problem to put on there. And I saw the list that was recently produced. There were 257 different products that could be allowed for use in Oregon. The concerning part of that is one includes capsaicin. It's like pepper spray. I don't think anybody wants to use that one. Other things that might be irritants to the airways, like cinnamon oil and stuff of that type. I think the list isn't too terribly bad. It's probably okay because people are going to look at that and say, no one's going to want my product if I use that anyway. So I think the general approach that's being taken so far is really a relatively good one that we see on the West Coast. It will lower the burden on labs. If you ask the lab to look for hundreds of pesticides and cultivating agents, it's really, really expensive, really, really challenging. You might do skip lot testing or random testing to see if cultivators are cheating the system and using that kind of stuff. And that might be the cheapest way to do it. And I would just leave that as we're a resource for later.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I would like to make the summary statements that I'm hearing you say that you feel like the list of pesticides that was identified as permissible recently by perhaps the Oregon Department of Agriculture is, in your opinion, possibly over-inclusive, but I thought I heard you say it was not hugely off the mark, but in your professional opinion, might be a little over-inclusive. I also feel like I heard you say the solvents that are permissible for use may be an over-inclusive list, although I saw some other information suggesting that that might just be the solvents tested for, not the solvents used. But in any event, my key takeaway is you have a lot of information at a technical level that exceeds the technical expertise of this body, but you might want to talk to folks at ODA as they do their final rulemaking and the Oregon Health Authority as they do their permanent rulemaking. It sounds like they're accepting comments right now. We are all trying to do the very best job we possibly can, and good input from people in our community with knowledge is really helpful. Thank you. Anyone have any comments that you'd like to make right now? I'd like to thank Senator Przanski for helping us connect with this good group of people.
Thank you. And I hope that the agencies are heard from these individuals. And I hope that they are actually going to bring them into the fold, because if we're all looking to take care of individuals, when I heard this presentation and understanding what someone may be inhaling, and if it's being measured as to what you are ingesting, it's apples and oranges. And that's the part of where I think we need to make certain that we go slowly here, be more precautious, so we don't have a lot of unintended consequences that are health risk to citizens in the state.
Thank you. That's great. I'm going to close the informational hearing on this. No, we didn't have an informational, did we? All right, we're closing that. And then before we adjourn the entire meeting, I want to thank people for being here to walk through the bills, listen to the hemp bills, which I think are really exciting, and listen to this presentation. The stage we're at right now is we're going to be continuing to refine the two committee bills that we've received testimony on and talked to many of you on, as we move forward in the process. And then I hear that Representative Buckley and Representative Wilson are going to be working together to see if they can get to points of agreement, and we'll look forward to seeing those bills come forward. So with that, we'll see you at the very beginning of session, and if you don't contact us first, which you're welcome to do, meeting is adjourned. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
First, which you're welcome to do, meeting is adjourned. Thanks.